Hi, this is Bob Rozakis. You're listening to the Batman Family Reunion on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Batman Family Reunion, a proud part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I am Sean M. Myers, one of your hosts, and with me as always is my co-host and bat cousin, Paul Keene. How are you this month, Paul?
I'm great, Sean. I was just talking to our bat cousin, Gary, though. He is really looking old, man.
He's still cool, though. I'm here with Bat Uncle Mark, and he's trying to do some funny voices, but the joke's on him. We want to welcome our bat cousin from across the Atlantic back to the reunion. That's right. It's Martin Gray. Martin, how are you? And more importantly, what did you bring for us to eat?
I'm great, and I've brought some mini fish and chips so that you have not those little skinny American fries, some proper potatoey chips with lovely scrumptious white fish covered in batter. Put the salt and vinegar on first, so the salt sticks in your heart, gets it. Mm-hmm. And it just is so much nicer than a Twinkie, but then again, so is a rock.
Paul, why don't you remind our listeners what our show is all about?
All right. Batman Family was a DC comic that ran for 20 issues from 1975 to 78, and then rescued Detective Comics from the DC implosion by continuing on as a dollar comic for 15 more issues until 1980. The title started out with new features starring Batgirl and Robin, along with reprints, before morphing into all new stories starring other members of the Batman family, such as the Huntress, Commissioner Gordon, Man-Bat, and even Roy Raymond TV Detective and the Odd Man. Both of your hosts collected and read these comics as they came out and are excited to share their love of this era of the Batman family reunion. So let's get into Detective Comics number 487, starring the Batman family.
It is Detective 487, and the cover date is December 79 to January 1980. The release date was actually on September 13th, 1979. It was a 64-page count with a cover price of $1, Dollar Comics. There are five stories, and the cover artist is Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
Martin, what do you think of the cover?
Well, lads, I quite like the cover. It's not the best Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, praise be his name, image I've ever seen, but it's a decent poster image of the three biggest Bat characters of the time. The brown background makes a nice change, and I love the white box art, as you know. But as I said regarding a recent issue, all the different typefaces down the side tend to combine into one big migraine. I don't know how you feel about that.
I agree with that, Martin. It's distracting from the beautiful image. There must be, what, 5 or 6 different font styles on the left-hand side.
Yeah, they're trying too hard to add interest. And as you say, an image that good doesn't need it. But what it does do, this image, as well as wondering who the terrific trio are trailing, glad I managed to say that, the cover brings up the question that's always bugged me. Why the heck does everyone in Gotham travel by running along rooftops and swooping down up the street? I mean, how much energy does it take to run across a building, avoiding the air conditioning units and water towers, the SVU detectives, stopping at the edge, hoping the next building's close enough to jump at, maybe a little lower if they're lucky? If they're starting from the ground, they have to climb up a fire escape or throw a rope because it's the 70s. It's blowing exhausting.
My first blush of this, Sean, is I love the composition. I think it's cool. You get a butt shot of Batgirl, of course. Jose loves that. But how is that swinging actually working? Look at where Batman's rope is.
Yeah, it's coming from behind him.
His rope should be in front of him.
Yeah, and Robin's going to trip over it as well.
Yeah, I know. That's the one minor thing. But yeah, it's a great image. Sean?
I'm kind of divided about, I think the three figures, fantastic. I like the brown building that they are on and the skyscraper behind them.
Yeah.
I like the moon. I absolutely hate that muddy brown background color, and I don't understand it at all. If it were black or night
purple,
or like a purplish or even orangish, like sunset, I don't understand that.
I think they were going for orange and it didn't come out.
Yeah.
It's too close to the building color.
Yeah. On Facebook, I actually forget who it is, what group I follow, but someone recolors covers all the time.
Oh, yes.
And uniformly, I think they all look horrible. I think he makes the absolute worst. And
we just lost another listener.
I'm not calling him out because I'm being like gracious. I'm not calling them out because I don't know who it is, because I've never paid attention. Because like it's a classic cover, but it's like modern coloring. And I hate when they do the choices that the person makes. I just think are bad choices. But I wouldn't mind if they took a swipe at this, because now I say that And they probably would get rid of the brown background and put it right. But then the white, they would probably make fluorescent green or something. So yeah, I don't want that to happen.
I do like the blue logo, though. Let's talk about that logo. Martin, you're our logo expert.
Yeah, I think it pops. I mean, the blue is the color of Batman's cape. It's nice against the white background. It works as well as anything could against that murky brown. As issues go for logos, there is something in this issue that excites me and makes me very, very happy. And starting with this logo, yep, it's no bother at all.
And one thing I want to point out about the cover, which I'm very happy, is to the left of the DC Bullet, last issue, it said 68 pages, no ads from cover to cover. But this time, in like the little explosion, it says, more for your money, the best buy in comics. But it doesn't mention no ads.
All right. Well, we will post the image of this cover as well as plenty of additional pages from the stories in our family portrait gallery on the network's website. Sean, could you please remind our listeners where that is?
Of course, it's fireandwaterpodcast.com. Now, let's jump into that first story.
Okay, the first story is starring Batman, of course, a 17-pager by Denny O'Neill, Don Newton, and Dan Adkins, entitled The Perils of Sergius, and has been reprinted in the Tales of the Batman Don Newton hardcover from 2012. Our story opens with a scrawny guy jogging through Gotham City at 4 a.m. That's got to be a smart idea, right? Well, our running friend Sergius also happens to be a writer, and he is working out the plot details of his latest story out loud as he jogs. So that's harmless, right? Not in Gotham. For some reason, the sensei and one of his goons are skulking about at 4 a.m. and happen to overhear Sergius. The details of his book are similar to their nefarious plans, and they think he somehow knows they are in town. He must be eliminated, but quietly, since they do not want the Batman to know they are in Gotham. The next morning, we cut to Bruce Wayne's shirtless gymnastic workout. Alfred reads him a classified ad that Sergius had written asking Batman to contact him. Bruce tells Alfred that Sergius is a hack who has tried to get Batman to let him write a book about him before. Bruce can't be bothered since Ma Murder has been released from prison after 20 years. In another example of O'Neill over-exaggeration, Bruce tells Alfred that Ma Murder is, quote, as mad as the Joker and potentially as dangerous. Yeah, right. Meanwhile, coincidentally, the sensei has come to hire Ma Murder to take out Sergius. Again, remember, even though Sensei is the head of the League of Assassins, he hires these clams to perform a murder since they don't want Batman to know that it's them. Ma says she can't do it herself. She's too old. But she knows that her trusty, reliable henchmen named Twitchy, Ape, and Chuckles can take care of it. Yeah, that inspires a lot of confidence in me, too. Twitchy goes first and tries rubbing out Sergius the old-fashioned way with a Tommy gun and a drive-by. But Sergius happens to trip over a cat just as the shots miss. Batman later confronts Ma and the boys in an all-night movie theater and gets Twitchy to confess. He warns Ma to back off Sergius as he takes Twitchy to jail. Ape is next, and he simply tries to drop a giant stone on Sergius as he runs by. Batman knocks Sergius out of the way and makes quick work of Ape. And then that night, we get a rare Batman family reunion sighting of Matches Malone, who visits Sergius at his apartment. Matches tells him that he has some run-ins with Batman in the past, and Sergius is all ears. But those ears soon hear a dripping faucet, and more water starts pouring into the apartment. Apparently, Sergius lives in a waterproof apartment. I'm sure Brett Young will tell us how that affects his rent. And within minutes, the water will be over their heads and they will drown. Sergius faints, allowing Batman to switch out of his Matches Malone outfit and into his bat plumbing gear. He messes with the pipes and breaks a hole through the wall, exiting into the hallway of the apartment building. There, of course, he takes care of business and apprehends Chuckles and Mom Murder, who just happen to stay at the scene of the crime to watch the waterworks. But the Dark Knight is not done, as he easily spots two of Sensei's assassins in disguise who were observing the observers. After he takes them out, he now knows who is really behind all the attempts on Sergius' life, but he still doesn't know why. Not that we know much more, but stay tuned for more League of Assassin hijinks next issue. Martin and Sean, your thoughts?
Yeah, It was better than I expected, because I've not been a big fan of Denny O'Neill in this period when he's just filling the book with either the Sensei in the League of Assassins or Bloomin' Maxie's use and he's killing Batwoman and things. So, but I mean, when I came up with the title, The Perils of Sergius, I'm expecting alliteration because of The Perils of Pauline. But Sergius, where we all know that Denny O'Neill used the pseudonym Sergius O'Shaughnessy when he was at Charlton Comics and writing the odd Super Friends. So I was expecting a piffling bit of whimsy. And while there is a bit of whimsy in terms of the goons in this one, I really enjoyed the mixture of lightheartedness with bonkers writer running along the streets at night and Batman protecting him. It was much better than I expected. I mean, yeah, overall thoughts. I mean, I got, you know, little points here and there, but overall, really enjoyed it.
How about you, Sean?
So, spoiler alert for this issue. Other than one story, I don't think any of these stories are really great, but I think they are very, very enjoyable. And I really like this. I echo a lot of what Martin says. It's not earth-shattering or earth-shaking. It's not particularly clever or anything like that, but it's really enjoyable. The characters are distinct. I liked it. I mean, I'll get into it beat by beat, but I like the story.
Yeah, I agree with both of you. It's goofy. It's funny. The art is beautiful. I mean, the art is great throughout. Absolutely. We have Don Newton is top of his game here. This is really, really terrific. But so, yeah, let's walk through. I mean, on the first page, you got this sort of great, almost gothic splash page, which is way more serious than the actual story, which I think is really pretty neat.
How do you feel about the coloring, though, of the Sensei on that splash page? It's not like how he's in the rest of the book.
Oh, yeah, because it's like a ghostly image of him.
I know, but it's unfortunate coloring, though.
Yeah, I guess it's too much like the sensationalistic 40s Asian stereotype, but I didn't read it that way when I read it. I read it more like Sean did as this sort of ghostly image shadowing Sergius. Hopefully that wasn't what they were going for, Martin.
I don't think it was. I think it was just sort of maybe didn't think quite. I think, you know, I know they were going for the ghosty thing, but I think just go for any color but a shade of yellow.
Yeah, maybe if it would have been more white or something.
Yeah,
that's fair. So I want to know what Sensei and his goon were doing in the alleyway at 4 a.m. happening to overhear Sergius. So there are a lot of things that just happen because they have to happen in this story, as we've seen in many stories.
Well, it was too subtle for me. It wasn't until reading the letter column a few issues later that I actually realised why they were after him. Even though they say, could he know? It's not possible. I was just so into the story and reading it quite dragged in. It didn't stick with me that was why they were after him. And I thought, we'll get a big reveal at the end. And then it wasn't. And I thought, we'll find out in a future issue. And I started looking through future issues to see if Sergius reappeared. And then it's like, I'm so stupid. My reading comprehension just isn't there. But yeah, I mean, what are they doing there? Because it is just madness. I mean, it's fun. It's offbeat. They should have put the word offbeat on the cover.
No, I like offbeat. Sean, you probably want to talk about page 3 first.
Well, actually, what I was going to say, I do go out running in the morning at like 5 or 6 o'clock. And I can tell you, so one time I tried to talk to a friend while I was jogging, and I found it close to impossible to talk and jog at the same time. So the fact that this guy is doing it, and I understand we'll get to the watertight apartment, but I think this was the most unbelievable part for me, that someone would just choose to talk while they were jogging. And
no, there are a few puffs. He's out of breath, certainly.
But you were saying, Paul, yes, I did love Bruce Wayne working out. Now, I would say shorty shorts would have been better, but I will take this.
But it's a little more realistic than the shorty shorts. I can see Bruce working out like this. I can see.
But it looks like he's borrowed Black Lightning's pants.
It does, yeah. Well, I'm not discounting that.
So then we get mom murder. So here we go. I talked about Denny once again, talking about how great these characters are with mom murder. As evil as the Joker? Come on, Denny.
It reminds me of like every kind of movie where the name is kind of the same, but they pronounce it Frankenstein. And I got every single instance of that. Murder.
I know. Yeah, we should tell the listeners her last name is actually Murder, M-H-U-R-D-E-R.
Yeah, Mabel Murder.
Yeah, Murder.
Murder.
It looks for all the word like, well, a man or granny goodness in a suit.
Yeah.
I would love to see a sequel in which there's another whimsical issue in which Sergius returns and Mar Murder is mistaken for granny goodness and kidnapped to Apocalypse. And I don't know. She should have come back. I don't think she did she?
Don Newton could have drawn it. Right?
Yep, him definitely. And the Turn of the New Gods.
And it kind of reminds me of, is it Shelley Winters when she was on?
Yes. I mean, it's a bit insulting to poor Shelley, but I know what you're going for.
So then Sergius trips over the cat.
Yeah, but I was wondering if it was going to turn out the Catwoman was protecting him for some reason, throwing cats across the...
Oh, I like that.
And then we have the scene in the movie theater where Batman steals some of Mom Murder's popcorn.
Well, that was surprising because I didn't know there were any film theaters in Gotham City that weren't constantly showing Zorro.
But they've got James Cagney instead. Of course, Mom Murder is going to see a James Cagney film, right?
Yeah, White Heat. Is that the one that ends with Top of the World, Ma?
I think that is White Heat. I think, yeah.
And this is an all-night movie theater. And look how crowded it is.
I will say this was very triggering for me. I do go to the movies quite often. But I will tell you one thing. If I'm there to watch a movie, I don't care if it's Batman breaking up a criminal gang. Be quiet. Go out in the lobby and do whatever you have to do. The fact that like all these people are standing up and clapping, no, that is the most unbelievable thing that happened to this video.
Although,
I would be furious.
Check out panel 2 at the top of the page.
Yes, that's me.
That's me.
Don Newton drew me into the story.
Yeah, luxurious hair, but yes. I love the scene though. Just it's just so amusing. How often do you see Batman with a cheesy grin taking the Mickey out of criminals?
Yeah, he's having a good time.
He understands the level of these criminals. That's definitely true.
So moving on, we get to Sensei lounging on his couch.
Yeah.
Smoking something there. I'm surprised we didn't see four scantily clad women draped all over him.
Oh, yeah, he's a repulsive little thing, isn't he?
Yes, he is. So you can tell Batman's just toying with him. Just like you said, Sean, because he knocks Sergius out of the way on page 9 and then is, again, laughing when he's taking on Ape.
What I don't get is since Batman knows there's a present threat to Sergius, why doesn't he take him in?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. He's using him as bait. I guess he's awfully confident that there's no way with him watching him that they can hurt him. You know, I don't know.
I think he just, yeah.
On page 10, after he smacks Ape, and maybe because his name is Ape, is it Sam Simeon? Is that Ape from Angel and the Ape?
Angel yeah. and the Ape.
Because yes, I think that he looks like Sam Simeon in that panel.
Oh, yeah.
Not there.
When his face is knocked to the side in the middle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, that's and Adrian Roy, you know, gives us a lovely pink background to emphasize that this is the panel to look at.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I forgot to ask a question. How did that man make the initial connection between Sergius and Ma Murder? He wasn't there at the first murder attempt when Sergius tripped over the cat.
That's a good point, but it could be that he's been doing a bit of matches Malone earlier in the story off panel, been listening to the underworld chatter. I don't know. I mean, it's basically, yeah, plot hole.
Yeah, so that's Sergius. Yeah. Has an attempt on his life.
Yeah.
And then the next thing we know, Batman is confronting Ma Murder.
Yeah.
Did he just figure, oh, since that terrible character Ma Murder has been released, this first crime in Gotham since then must be her?
It could be. Or maybe he's been having
maybe,
some
maybe he's been watching them. I don't know. Who knows? Yeah. All right. So let's move on. So then we get, I love the panel of Batman in Ma Murder's office, in her chair, leaning back in the chair with his feet up on the table.
Yeah. It is great. Well, they say is it Chuckles, the blonde one, whether he's basing anyone by Don Newton, because very distinct looking.
Oh, yeah. I love how Don Newton has these characters that all look different. There are no stock characters. That's just really impressive. So then we get to the big scene of the issue. So listeners, Batman gets in his matches Malone, and this is where he decides to hang out with Sergius. Knows it's going to be another attempt on his life. Why he thinks this time it won't be while he's running, I don't know. But for some reason, Batman says, I'm going to be matches and I'm going to make friends. And I'm going to tell him that I know a lot about Batman. So Sergius will be interested in me because he wants to write a book about Batman, right? Okay. So they go into the apartment with a steel door. Okay. Number one. And matches even draws attention to it. And they start hearing the drip, drip, drip. And then all of a sudden the water starts pouring in everywhere. And the water is pouring in. They try to get out the door and you've got Chuckles there with a hammer and nails in his mouth. You know how people hold a couple of nails in their mouth and they hammer.
I didn't even notice that.
Hammering the door closed. Everything is watertight and it starts filling up. It's chest high within a couple of minutes. I remembered this scene because this is just a crazy scene. I don't know what you guys thought about this.
I absolutely love death traps. I think I've said it before. I always think they are great. Yeah, it's so dumb to think this apartment is waterproof. But I will say the 10 out of 10 is Matches Malone. Unless Matches Malone is possessed by the spirit of Boston Brand, it doesn't get better than Matches Malone. I will forgive everything because Matches Malone is in here.
I was thrown by the lack of sunglasses. I've never seen him without sunglasses.
Yeah.
I can or the hat. Or the
yeah.
Jacket.
Well, he's casual because he doesn't have his jacket on. I can buy that. I was wondering what he was doing without his sunglasses too.
Yeah, because that's part of the persona.
The ears tucked into the mask would throw the sunglasses off.
We actually don't see him pull off the mask.
No, I don't I don't think it's
the bottom of 13 is just him with his bat outfit underneath. And then the next panel, we just see him with the mask on. So we don't actually see that, unfortunately. No, we don't see that.
But I do love how much work, I mean, bottom of page 12, how much work Don Newton puts into making that apartment look realistic. Because he could have got away with it, with just being a lot simpler. But he's drawn everything.
Yeah, I know. He's got the pen on the counter. He's got paper towels on the roller. It's like, why doesn't Batman just break the window? There's all kinds of
things. That's what I was thinking too.
All kinds of goofy stuff going on. But nonetheless, Batman goes under the sink and somehow plumbs out a part of the drainage so the water will drain out. Then he uses it to bash a hole through the wall, which apparently is made of rocks, because if you look at the bottom of page 14, I guess maybe it's since it's not drywall, the entire building, even the internal walls are made of stone. And he sees Mom Murder and chuckles. And then he's very politely takes Chuckles' glasses off before he clobbers him. And then this is on par with knowing every license plate. Batman susses out the League of Assassins observers because, quote, no teenager has worn pedal pushers in years.
But there was no indication that these were meant to be teenagers anyway. I just thought, like, a couple of middle-aged people hanging around in the horse.
Don might have made that just too subtle.
It also doesn't make really a ton of sense because, literally, I have a jacket that I got from Old Navy back in probably 98 to 99, and I still wear that jacket. I am not a stylish fashion plate whatsoever, but it's a black jacket. I can't imagine it goes in and out of style. Even if it was a shirt that said the movie Dante's Peak or whatever, people wear old stuff all the time. It doesn't have to be up to date for someone to wear clothes.
How is it relevant one way or the other?
I guess what he was going for is this is someone who is disguising themselves as a teenager, and a teenager would not be seen in an out-of-date fashion. I think that's what they were going for, but it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make sense that they're assassins at all. I mean, the whole idea that the League of Assassins need more murder in the first place, and then you've got these two who are supposedly professional assassins, and they're just hanging around not to do, you know, because they must know that something's going wrong, and they're doing nothing to kill. They could just somehow kill Sergius, presumably.
I do like that is explained in the story, because literally I was thinking, I'm like, why aren't they just killing them? But they don't want Batman to know that they're there. So I'm fine with that. Hard.
It's weak. I get it. I don't necessarily buy it, but you know, that is what it is. So
one thing I do want to point out, because this is my new gig, apparently, on page 7 in the movie theater, when they're fighting.
Did you find another typo, Sean?
Yes, I did. And it's not the last in the issue. The third panel, he says, packing heat, huh? That's a no-no, Twitchy. Especially when you're as slow as a snail with
arthritis. My gosh, look at that.
I will say the first time I read the story was at work and I was using the DC Universe Infinite, so I didn't notice it. But then this morning when I was rereading it, I did
see. When you were reading it backwards?
Yes, exactly.
What's the typo?
So it should be your Y-O-U apostrophe R-E.
Oh, sorry. Yes, indeed. See, I'm not reading it backwards.
I know. Good catch, Sean. You're really getting good at this. We've enjoyed this story. Very silly. Plot holes aplenty, but still enjoyable.
Absolutely. And it has a happy ending because he's going to get his interview, we know. So that's
good. That's nice. Yeah. So let's move on. I would like to get to our Bat Family History spotlighting Don Newton. Artist did a fabulous job in that last story, and I'd like to give him his due. Don was born in 1934 in St. Charles, Virginia. But after being diagnosed with asthma at the age of 4, the Newton family moved to Arizona. Newton began drawing at a very young age, with comic books being a major influence on his early artwork. He was a big fan of Batman and Daredevil. That's the original one, not Matt Murdock. And an even bigger Captain Marvel fan. Again, the original one. By the 1960s, Newton was teaching art in Phoenix and working part-time as a student art reviewer for the mail-order Master Artists Painting course, which I thought that was interesting. He eventually discovered comic book fandom while searching for a source to purchase old comics. Newton became involved with the Science Fiction and Comics Association and became an artistic staple in the organization's publications. Between 1968 and 73, he produced almost 24 covers for the Rocket Blast fanzine Comic Collector. Sean, I think this is the same fanzine that my pal Dan mentioned last month about how he knew Don Newton, which I thought that was cool. Newton did one major comic strip during this time, which ran for more than a year, called The Savage Earth. The science fiction strip appeared in issues 60 to 70 of that comic collector. He tried for years to leverage his connections in fandom into work at DC or Marvel, but was at a distinct disadvantage living in Arizona. Marvel, in particular, wanted their artists close at hand. Newton finally set his sights a little lower and sent some sample pages to Charlton Comics. Starting in 1974, Newton started working for Charlton's horror titles. In October of 75, his first issue of The Phantom, number 67, was published. Newton would pencil and ink all of his Phantom work and would supply a cover painting for every issue he drew. For example, his final issue of The Phantom features the Phantom of 1776 meeting Benjamin Franklin. The cover is phenomenal. It has the Phantom of 1776, a sword in one hand, a flintlock pistol in the other, in front of a smoky background of the Declaration of Independence, and a tattered 13-star American flag. You can see this image on Newton's Wikipedia page, which I will, of course, include a link to in the show notes. That image is also the cover of a Hermes Press book with all of Newton's Phantom stories, which is out of print. I don't have that one, but I do have a similar one of Jim Aparo's Phantom stories. I don't really care one way or much or another about the Phantom, but they are really cool books, and the Hermes Press books always have excellent production values. So if you can see that in a con or something, pick it up. Newton had always seen Charlton as a stepping stone to Marvel. While still working for Charlton, Newton had some uncredited work on an issue of Giant Size Defenders and the Deadly Hands of Kung Fu magazine. He also did a fronts piece for The Savage Sword of Conan and a single painting for Roy Thomas, which years later became a cover for Thomas's magazine, Alter Ego. But Newton, of course, is best known for his work at DC. His first DC work was the Aquaman story in the DC special Earth-Shattering Disasters from 1977. He would draw Aquaman off and on for the next 3 years. And that same month also saw the release of Newton's first series at DC, The New Gods, number 12. It was during his tenure on this strip that he finally left his job as a junior high school art teacher to go full-time work as an artist. In the middle of his run on The New Gods, he and David Michelinie also created the Star Hunters for DC, but Newton dropped off that feature after drawing just two stories. One of Newton's lifelong ambitions was to draw Captain Marvel, and he fulfilled this desire in 1978 when he was signed on as the new penciler for Shazam. He would draw this strip on his own title as well in World's Finest and Adventure Comics until October 1982. I know you love that one, Sean.
Yeah.
And as we know, Newton began drawing the Batman family characters with the Fantastic Batman Family number 13, The Man Who Melted Manhattan, starring Batgirl, Robin, and Man-Bat, we discussed over a year ago. His first Batman story was Batman number 305 from November 1978, over a year later. He would draw 79 stories featuring Batman or members of the Batman family during his tenure at DC. In 1979, Newton returned to Marvel. He wanted to draw Captain America, but that title was unavailable at the time, and the Avengers was the closest Marvel could do to fulfilling that request. He took the assignment when he was promised Joe Rubinstein as his permanent inker on the book. That didn't happen, so Newton finished the pencils for only two issues before returning to DC. Those two issues of the Avengers became Avengers Annual number 9, which we talked about last month. And I was like, man, we don't see Don Newton Marvel art very often. Well, this is what it was. Half of that was inked by Rubenstein, but the other half was inked by Jack Abel. Newton did two issues of Green Lantern in 1982. Both were Green Lantern core stories, one of which contained the first appearance of Chip, the squirrel-like Green Lantern. And as we know, he also drew the first appearance of pre-crisis Jason Todd in Batman number 357 in 1983. Newton had always told DC that the only series he would like to draw other than Batman and Captain Marvel was the All-Star Squadron. Roy Thomas tapped into that interest by proposing that Newton draw Infinity Inc. That first issue scheduled to contain Newton's art was Infinity Inc. number 11 from 1984, which would have featured a five-page framing sequence by Newton surrounded by the rest of the story drawn by George Tuska. Newton was to begin penciling the entire book with number 12, but the letters page in number 11 told of Newton's death. Newton had suffered a massive heart attack in his home after dealing with months of a debilitating throat ailment. He died in the hospital a few days later. As a final tribute to Newton, Marvel editor-in-chief Jim Shooter let Joe Rubinstein out of his contract for a month so he could ink a fill-in issue that Newton had done. It became Infinity Inc. number 13. This was Newton's last published work. Mike's Amazing World lists only 167 story credits, which total about 2,500 pages of published art. This does not include his fanzine work, nor his Charlton work, of course. He rarely got to do covers. I mentioned last month that cover to Avengers Annual, but there are only a handful of Batman covers. The most famous one is Detective Comics number 526 that has Batman, Robin, and Batgirl running towards us. He was a terrific talent. We have been enjoying his art for quite some time here at the reunion. It was quite a shame that his life was cut so short at the age of 50, but thanks for listening and giving him his due a little bit.
One thing I want to point out, Don Newton, and I don't know if it was just once or several times, he dressed up as Captain Marvel in a fantastic Captain Marvel outfit.
Yeah, see, I heard he was a bodybuilder, and I'd like to see a picture.
We'll include it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because the picture of him on the Wikipedia page was the one, I think, that printed in DC Comics when he was starting out at some point.
That was his self-portrait, yeah.
Yeah, he looks like a mobster from Guys and Dolls.
Yeah, it's a shame. I really like the art in this past story that we just talked about. You know, he's really had just a unique style, very kinetic.
It really was. The way he would draw people looking a little bit lumpy, very realistic, like statues come to life. There was no one else like him.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on, Sean, to our second blockbuster story.
The title is The Aliens Among Us. It's starring Roy Raymond, TV detective, six pages.
You're excited, aren't you?
Bob Razakis, penciled by Dave Hunt, inked by Dave Hunt. Later, rightfully reprinted in Never. My synopsis is, Roy Raymond, famous TV detective, is prepping for his anniversary show of Impossible But True. Ray is going to interview four aliens, one a robot, one a phantom, one a strongman, and the last one a beautiful human-looking woman. Ray reveals that the first three are fakes created by the GBS production crew, and the last one, a true alien, Hulk Girl. I found this story impossible to like. That's true. What did you guys think?
Do you want to go first, Paul?
I want you to do the whole thing because I don't want to talk about this story at all.
Oh, heavens. Go ahead, Martin. What are your thoughts on the story?
Okay, first of all, 1,000,000 points for giving us the original logo from his Detective Comics run. And, you know, the fact that he was in Detective Comics, that makes him a legitimate character having the Batman family Detective Comics issues. No problems there. And I always liked Roy Raymond. I read a few stories, I think, presumably, because I'm not that old, in reprinting 100-page spectaculars or 48, 50.
Yes, that's exactly where I would have seen his stories, yes.
And I remember him showing up in the old Superman story in the Bronze Age. So, yes, he was at WGBS. But, I mean, talk about a character of his time, you know, TV, detective TV, so amazingly exciting. But I was excited to see him still at WGBS and Morgan Edge. I was very surprised that Morgan Edge was dubious about there being aliens, given that he was kidnapped by Darkseid's people. And
I didn't see Superman all the time.
Yeah, really.
Yes, he rather does, yes.
And why would the human one be the alien? Aliens have to look alien. And he sees Superman all the time.
It's mad. But did he not even like the fact that one of the aliens was called Ugh? U-G-G-G-H.
Yeah, they got that one right. Ugh.
Well, Bob is naming the characters here, Sean. He's naming the characters.
Yes, that is true. Yeah, I'm nice for that, thing. Yes.
But I thought it was good because one alien was a little bit brainiac. One was Phantom Girl. One was a bit Jean Jones. And then there was the Mystery Woman, who in the splash panel looks like the Spectre with her colouring. If you look at the bottom of page 4, when they're chatting about the aliens in the foreground and the background, what are the aliens doing? They're doing like a little close dance together or something.
It looks like they're dancing.
It does look like they're dancing. Oh, so that's one point for it.
I don't know. Yeah, you've got Dave Hunt, who usually is an inker, right? He does penciling and inker here, in which you can tell what's happening. It's an okay art job. I think it's a little uninspiring.
Yeah, the faces are not consistent from panel to panel. I would expect better from Dave Hunt. Okay, why are Roy's own staff trying to prank him or fool the public? I mean, won't that harm Roy's reputation?
Yeah, I don't understand this story. Like, who was asking for this? Did Paul Levitz ask Bob to write a story about this? Did Bob want to come up with this? Who's asking for Roy Raymond TV tickets?
Is this before we had the Whatever Happened To stories in DC? Yeah, it's long before. It's about 6 years before, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. So well, DC Comics Presents has just started, right? If we go back to our timeline. So they haven't got to Whatever Happened To yet.
I do have a theory, and Bat Cousins, we'll get to this later. Isamu, this is not a call for you because you have gone above and beyond the call of duty. So, Isamu, do not. This is not a task for you, but...
Do it, do it.
Does anybody know... Wasn't there some kind of thing where DC had to publish a character within a certain amount of time frame to keep the copyright? Maybe it's, you know, like that Steamboat Willie thing where he just laughed.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe.
Didn't DC have to publish characters or else they would... Is that why Roy Raymond is in
here? Why would they want to, Sean?
Yeah.
Even I say, why? I mean, although I did actually, when Firestorm began, I did send a letter across the ocean to Jerry Conway suggesting they made Roy Raymond TV detective the uncle of Roddy Raymond because Ooh. I am that sad. Yes. But in fact,
they that's made a very Roy Thomas thing of you to
yeah.
do.
Yeah. But they ignored me, and I think they made Uncle Captain X of the RAF instead, who everyone was demanding.
Part of my problem, too, is I swear back, cousins, this is coming back to Batman Family, but there's an Alfred Hitchcock movie called Stage Fright. And yep. a lot of Alfred Hitchcock fans really don't like Stage Fright because one of the characters is telling a story and we see the story told through that character. But then we find out that that's not true. So it's like a false flashback. Mm-hmm. But yep. because we're seeing the flashback, you as a viewer assume that that is the truth. So yeah. I think when the robot's talking, he's like, I was made by these aliens. And then you see the aliens, you see the rocket take off, the phantom person, you see him lounging in his chair, watching TV. So the fact that we see these fake flashbacks, I think that kind of adds to the, what's the point of this then? Because it's not true.
Well, I don't, because with Stage Fright, it's the movie where we're getting a Sean, but here we're seeing that they're getting narrated individually by the individual aliens.
Yeah.
And I think that actually, okay, Hawk Girl, random, she must have been very bored that day. But I think Bob Lazarkis was basically giving the readers a fair play mystery because a smart kid could have worked out some of the clues, although not for Hawk Girl. Instead of Madame X, they could have called her something like Madame Akipitridae, which is the family to which hawks belong. He could have done something like that.
Yeah, you know, that's great. Well, she does say she's from Polaris, which we know that Thanagar orbits the star Polaris, and there are clues in here. That's a good point. I think it is a fair play mystery, Sean, because I think there are enough clues to know which ones are faked, and Roy Raymond points them out.
And I will say, partly, I guess, because of the medium of comics, how do you know someone telling you something that's not true versus, quote unquote, comic book science? Because I was reading this, I'm like, the Phantom people are watching commercials for a TV show? Like, I thought, that's kind of dumb. But as it turns out, that's a clue, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't dumb, it was a clue.
And this was a very early Silver Age character brought back. And to me, it made as much sense as anything else. That, you know, they're giving these stories out and they may be true, they may not. But, you know, the feature was originally called Impossible But True for the TV show. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, you're meant to be a little bit dubious about things.
So I have a couple other notes. I do like how Roy Raymond seems to be very close to his old assistant, BH6, the woman who's married with four children in Arizona.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I thought that was funny. I laughed when I saw that. The other thing that it reminded me of, DC had a lot of characters in the 50s and 60s, and maybe Bob was a fan, because I had read the Phantom Stranger Omnibus, I don't know, 6 months ago or so, the whole run of the Phantom Stranger, and really enjoyed 70, 80% of it. But, you know, a recurring character, they put together Dr. 13. And Dr. 13 was the same thing. He was there to debunk the people who were mystical, and that he was on a tirade because he wanted to prove the Phantom Stranger was a fraud, which of course he wasn't. And so he was a supporting character in the Phantom Stranger, who's almost a co-star in a number of the stories. And Roy Raymond, TV detective, is the same exact character. I hadn't realized that before. I mean, I'd only read a few Roy Raymond, like you said, Martin, and many years ago, and reading 100-page super spectaculars when they stuffed his stories in there. So I thought that was interesting, sort of like you had the Sea Devils and the Challengers. And,
yeah.
And so it's interesting. If they find something that people tend to like, and then they duplicate it till people don't like it.
Yeah, and that's a brilliant observation, Paul. And of course, they did bring Dr. 13 back in his own strip in, was it Secrets of Haunted House, one of those comics, a couple of years later around this time. And his legacy is in the DC universe to this day, to Tracy 13.
Yes.
And given... just the right amount of reader interest, Roy Raymond could have been just as big as Dr. 13.
Yeah, it's just interesting. Anyway, that was the most interesting thing I thought about the story that I reflected on.
I thought the most interesting thing was on page 6, the very last panel, when he says, so when I realized the first 3 quote-unquote aliens were phonies set up by the staff, I decided to fake everybody out.
Sean, you are a magician. I have to start reading these things backwards, Martin.
Yeah, that's really good. Actually, but there is another Batman family link to Roy Raymond, which you probably know. Have you heard of Roy Raymond II, who is actually his grandson?
I don't recall that one, Martin.
Roy Raymond II, Roy Raymond Jr., is in fact a member of one iteration of The Outsiders that we had a few years ago. And the character in The Outsiders that he was Owlman. And of course, in the first story in this issue, yeah, Sergius is writing about Owlman.
Yeah, you're right.
Sergius was dreaming of Earth 3.
Wow, I had put that Outsider series out of my head, but now that you say it, I remember that now, Martin.
I've saved just to move some time.
Well done. I'm impressed.
Martin, that is some The Question whiteboard with a red string reasoning. Good job. Very good job. Now, the best thing about the Roy Raymond story is that little box at the very end that says end.
You're mean.
We are. That was mean. So we are.
Why are you going to be so mean?
We are going to move on to the Bat timeline. Thank God. In this segment, we are going to take a look at the other titles that were published this month using Mike's Amazing World of Comics. And that link is for September 1979. And we're going to start off with Batman number 318, and it is Batman versus Firebug. It was written by Len Wein and Irv Novik. A fantastic cover by JLGL. If you think you don't know this book, you probably do when you see the cover, because that cover is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
I've never read that story, but it just the name Firebug for a villain. Oh my God, it just makes so much sense.
Yeah. No, dig the story out. It'll be on DC. It'll be on the DC app, and if not, it's probably in the Tales of the Batman Len Wein, because the whole run, I mean, from the second Paul Levitz took it off his ends with the Batman book, Len Wein, Jerry Conway, Doug Mensch. You can read it for about 10 years, and it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see a villain wearing red and yellow. You don't really see that a lot. Usually it's like heroic colors. The next one is The Brave and the Bold, and that is Batman and Commandy, and it is called Time, My Dark Destiny. And I'm not a huge Commandy fan, so I'll let someone else who maybe likes that character talk about it if you can.
Next up, we have DC Comics Presents number 16, starring Superman and Black Lightning. Huh? Well, guess what, listeners, in case you didn't know, Black Lightning's coming our way in a few issues. So we're counting him as part of the Batman family. Similarly, Justice League number 173, amazingly in this day and age, does not feature Batman, but does guest star Black Lightning, who turns down the invitation to join the jive bunch of turkeys in the JLA.
That's a fantastic cover.
Oh, yeah. Black Lightning says no.
The next one is Super Friends number 27, and that is the spacemen who stole Atlantis. And it's a fantastic cover because it's exactly what you think it is. It's a big spaceship. It's lifting Atlantis right up out of the ocean. And Aquaman, of course, is leaping up trying to save it, as are the other Super Friends. We're going to pour one out for our dearly departed to all mankind. Loved being on that show. If you haven't listened to it, now's a great time to binge all of the episodes, all 50 episodes, because they were each great.
And finally, the Bat Books World's Finest number 260, with a cover by Rich Buckler of Batman flying in to save Superman, promising us the 4 billion Supermen of Earth. We also get stories of the Atom, Black Lightning, and Captain Marvel. So what else did you have, Martin?
Oh, well, I wasn't Richie Rich, but I did buy all the DC and Marvel superhero titles, except for the impossible generally to find dollar comics. Mm. But among the favourites that month, there was Flash 280, which was, I think you mentioned last issue. It was another chapter in the Death of Iris storyline. And this one featured Melanie, the girl who fancied the Flash, yep, until she saw him without his mask and declared him as being too ordinary.
I know, I love that one.
Been there.
Talk about me being mean.
Oh. Yeah, really.
I mean, but the thing is, Barry Allen looked like Robert Redford. He was amazingly handsome. Anyway, over at Green Lantern 123, we had that another mad woman, Carrie Limbo, as Green Arrow lost his cover billing and Gil Kane provided an instant classic cover. Do you remember that one?
Yes, it's a great one. Yeah, and this was of note because it's the first Green Lantern solo book in a long time.
Yeah.
And when you talk about a comic book cover, that cover made me buy Green Lantern. Yeah, I bought, bought that off of the stands because of that beautiful cover. And years later, we always used to vacation in Rehoboth, and there was a comic book shop there, and they had that image on the black T-shirt, and I bought that. It was so fantastic.
Oh, I would. I think that was the first time I'd seen Gil Kane at DC for years. Maybe that was when he returned from Marvel. I don't know. Yeah. Before he did a Superman run in Action Comics. But anyway, talking of Marvel, there was Master of Kung Fu 83, which was Shang-Chi at his peak, under future Batman writer Doug Mensch and classic artist Mike Zeck and Gene Day. And the comic only got better when Gene Day started doing the solo art. So were you fancy the Master of Kung Fu?
You know, I didn't when it was coming out, Martin. But a few years ago, when Marvel reacquired the rights to reprint them, I did buy the 4 Omnibuy.
Oh, me too.
And man, it was great. I really enjoyed it. Really, really good. If you haven't read those, they're hard to get. They did a couple of epics, but the omnibuses, you know, you might be able to find them at a show or a store somewhere.
Yeah. Well, we're talking of omnibuses from Marvel. The biggest thing from the House of Ideas this month was the debut of Rom Space Knight. And I was with the book from start to finish. And I'm thrilled to say that my Romnibus arrived this month.
Romnibus.
This is another one, Martin. I didn't pick up ROM, probably fancied myself too old. So, although I was loving the Micronauts, why I didn't pick up ROM, I have no idea. I don't know. I just didn't buy it. But I, too, bought the Romnibus, and I am 3/4 of the way through it after only a week, and it's terrific.
It's wonderful.
Bronze Age Bill Mantlo goodness. The art by Sal Buscema is really good. He's not as stiff as I think he gets later in some of his Spidey work.
Have the inkers Aiken and Garvey come in yet at the point you're at? I think they may not be in this volume.
No, it only goes up to 29.
A couple of things that Ian Aiken and Brian Garvey, they haven't done a lot of comics work, but they're with Rom for a few years. Mm-hmm. And they just start adding just some fantastic textures and feels and brushwork. And they really give interesting added depth to Buscema's work. And for me, that's when Rom got even better. I have one more, Spider-Woman 21. And that represented the most boring change of direction ever, is this spooky Mark Gruenwald Carmen Infantino run, was succeeded by Michael Fleischer's insipid Bounty Hunter period. I mean, we were stuck with that for a couple of years until Chris Claremont and Steve Leolaha, I can't say it, apologies, came out of the book. Were you reading Spider-Woman, guys?
Well, wait, Martin. So you weren't complimentary about the story, but you do still want it reprinted in an affordable means, correct?
I do. I think, no, absolutely. Reprint Spider-Woman from the Marvel Spotlight days through Marv Wolfman, Carmine Infantino, and Mark Gruenwald. Then you can skip the Michael Fleischer and Frank Springer, then come back for Chris Claremont.
I, too, read Spider-Woman was coming out. Enjoyed it, my copy. Copies are long gone. Sean is continuing to try to bring the power of the Fire and Water
I
Network.
I can tell.
We only have a couple more issues for me to have this happen. So.
But yeah, I mean, Spider-Woman, I mean, she could be a DC character with the amount of origin rewrite she's
So Sean, what'd you have?
Okay, the first pick I have, I'm actually not going to buy. So it's Action Comics number 502, and it's called The Fall and Rise of the Star Child. And the reason why I'm not buying this issue is because it will later be reprinted in the Best of DC Digest number 5, the year's best comic stories. Yay! So I don't have to buy the issue because I'm going to get it for $1.25 instead of the 95 cents, but I was still more than happy. That beautiful cover with everyone at the awards ceremony. Love it.
Oh, you will enjoy it.
I love those digests, obviously. My next pick is Fun and Games Magazine number 4 from Marvel. I loved that issue. I had maybe not most of the original run, but I had several issues of the original run. And I wasn't getting a lot of Marvel comics, but I always loved that because it was fun and games and I love puzzles and stuff like that. The next one I absolutely love. You know how like dead people can come back and stuff like this. This is something that only makes sense to comic book people. The comic title, it's from the UK, Marvel UK, not just because Martin's on the show, but I would have highlighted this anyway. So the comic title is Marvel Superheroes number 353. And on the cover, it says, first, giant issue. Which I actually did research. We know I don't do. I actually did research in this. So there were 352 issues. It was either renamed or they weren't giant.
No, it was usually called Mighty World of Marvel. It was a weekly comic.
Okay. And then my last pick, of course, is Time Warp. I said it before, I'll say it again. Time Warp is one of my all-time favorite comic logos ever. I love it, love it, love it. I wish they would have reprinted a bunch of the different Time Warp stories into a digest. I think that would be like a great format for that. So Time Warp ran 5 issues. I think I have 3 of them. I don't have this one, so I want it. So I want to go on eBay before you guys bid out from under me. Paul, what's on your pull list?
Didn't have at the time, but I'm going to call out Amazing Adventures #1, reprints X-Men #1, and Fantasy Masterpieces #1, reprints Silver Surfer #1. I didn't have them as a kid. I was still Marvel-wise, mainly just into Spidey and FF and the Avengers characters. Hadn't branched out as much, but this is the period where Marvel's starting up a whole bunch of reprint books or trying to really corner of the market, but it is notable that they reprinted those.
You're talking about Fantasy Masterpieces with Silver Surfer. I just got the Mighty Marvel Masterworks of Silver Surfer, but I haven't even opened it yet. And I've never read Silver Surfer ever in my life.
Those are good stories. And, you know, it's Stan Lee being pretty verbose, but the art's really nice. John Buscema. Amazing Spider-Man #199, 1 month off to 200. We're not going to cover 200 because it'll be in our off month. But this one is a 4-box cover, so I'm sure Sean loves it. But Spidey is fighting Mysterio.
I love the image of Mysterio. I absolutely think he looks fantastic. I just love that villain.
Next up, you've got Fantastic Four #213. You've got Reed fighting Terrax. You've got Marv Wolfman and John Byrne on this issue. It's the time before Byrne's famous run. He drew a number of issues written by other people, but that's just a dynamic cover that would have easily parted me from my 40 cents.
Oh, superb.
So I had to pull out Heartthrobs, the best of DC romance comics hardcover. Okay, I had no idea this existed. On eBay, this trade paperback is going for $50 to $100. I don't think I would pay that. I would pay $5 for it, but it looks neat. You know, I'm not much for romance comics, but to know that there was a hardcover collection and later reprinted in paperback is kind of cool.
I think I have that. I'm looking on my shelf. I can't see, but I think I have that. I'm pretty sure.
That's pretty neat. Marvel Team Up #88 has Spider-Man and the Invisible Girl, not Woman. And Annual #2 has Spidey and the Hulk. And then I'd like to point out Micronauts Annual #1. This has art by Steve Ditko. So at the same time he did the Odd Man stories published in DC, he's published the Micronauts Annual. So there was a lot of Steve Ditko on the stands at this time. I read the whole run of Micronauts last year and enjoyed it. Just like we enjoyed his art on the Demon. His art is weird enough that it fits in the Micronauts world. Not as good as Michael Golden's, but certainly fun. And last but not least, I'm surprised you didn't point out, Sean, but Superboy and the Legion of Heroes #258, a great cover by Rich Buckler, but more importantly, this is the last issue. Next month, or off month, it becomes the Legion of Superheroes only, and we get the New Adventures of Superboy. This book splits into two.
Spoiler alert, we'll be talking about this later in this episode.
No, spoiler alert.
I think it's a wonderful month at the newsstand.
Yeah, it was a great month. All right, but let's move on to the third story starring Robin called The Iron Solution. It's a 10-pager written by Jack C. Harris with art by Kurt Schaffenberger and Joe Giella. And it was reprinted only in that Robin Bronze Age omnibus. The board of directors for Wayne Enterprises' West German subsidiary has a special guest today. Dick Grayson, the apparently 12-year-old ward of Bruce Wayne, is paying a visit to learn about his guardian's business operations abroad. Dick assures them that he's really 19. He's just drawn by Kurt Schaffenberger today. Anyway, the meeting is going all wah, wah, wah for a bored Dick until he perks up during the board's discussion about a robbery at one of their bank locations. That night, Dick changes to Robin to investigate. He finds tank tracks, so he heads to the nearest U.S. Army base. I guess the German police aren't much better than Chief McDonald at finding clues. While snooping around at the base, Robin befriends a young sergeant, who, since Jack C. Harris is upholding the Bob Razakis tradition, remains unnamed throughout the whole story. They see a tank being loaded into a truck, and Robin hitches a ride on the roof of the truck. Somehow, then, Robin uses an elongated fake version of his leg and foot to trick the driver of the truck. I'd like to say that was one of the more unusual sentences I've ever written, but knowing this show, I probably wouldn't be correct. Anyway, he stops the truck. The police come. We open up the back. No tank. I bet Robin wishes he had Roy Raymond TV Detective along for this adventure. The next day, Robin hears about a robbery that happened while he was legging after the wrong truck. He realizes that the model tank could move sideways, so must have moved from one truck to another when they were all lined up. That also means his nameless sergeant friend was in on it too. He returns to the base and takes care of his kind of business by putting the sergeant and his pals away. The end. Martin, what did you think?
I mean, the big thing it's got going for it is that it's got Dick Grayson somewhere else other than Hudson, you know, Hudson University, which we now know isn't in Florida. Thank you for reminding me. But I mean, I love the idea. It does make sense. As far as, you know, I think Dick was studying law at university. That might be leading him towards a business career, inheriting Wayne Enterprises. It makes some kind of sense that he would be there. And just to see Robin away from Hudson U and the possibility of running into ex-girlfriend Laurie Elton. I like it. I mean, yeah, I've got a few other little points, but generally I liked it, especially the secret cameo by Elongated Man.
Sean, how about you?
So I like it a lot of what Martin was saying. I probably will say that all throughout this episode. Yeah, I love that it takes place in Germany. I love that it's like on an army base. I don't know that necessarily that it's fair play, but it has like a cool little twist to it. And I have to admit, I was totally taken in by the soldier. It did surprise me that he was up to no good.
He seemed so friendly at the beginning. Yes, that was good.
And even though sometimes Robin is looking a little bit younger, I think there are like attempts. His shirt is definitely like open more to suggest more of like a manliness. Yeah, so I liked it. I liked it a lot.
I would say page 4, I mean, on the art, I think that's the best illustration by Kurt Scaffenberger of Robin that we've seen. And I would imagine that's because we've got the Silver Age Inga Joe Giello on it. But when, you know, that middle, where he's leaping, it's just fantastic.
Hey, you're right. That looks a little Carmine Infantino / Joe Giello-ish.
As you reminded us on one of the creator profiles recently, Kurt Scaffenberger immigrated to the US from Germany at age 7. So, you know, I'm expecting a great deal of authenticity here.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. Knowing about this, he must have enjoyed drawing some of this architecture. You see that German style home behind Robin in that panel in particular. For all we know, Kurt said, hey, can we draw an adventure of Robin in Germany? And Jack C. Harris says, sure, sounds like fun.
That's probably his grandma sitting at the boardroom table. She's undoubtedly called Helga.
Helga looks like she has a haircut out of Heidi. The panel right after that, you've got Dick really giving the secretary the eye.
They make it a point to say, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be conducting this meeting entirely in English for the benefit of a special guest, the word of Herr Wayne himself, Herr Dick Grayson. So they keep saying Herr because that's the only German word that Americans know. I thought that was hilarious.
Mein Herr. But I mean, it's not impressive because Dick presumably occasionally goes to meetings of the International Batman and Robin Society. He should be able to speak a few words.
Yeah, nowadays they all speak every language, right? Yeah. So
true.
I do like the ghostly Robin image on page 3 where Dick is sort of doing a little detective work. Then we get that page you mentioned, Martin, where he's going out on the town as Robin.
And I say well done to JCH for pointing out that Dick wouldn't be as familiar with the streets of Stuttgart as he is with New York, Metropolis, Gotham, etc.
Robin gets at the base and he makes friends with the sergeant. He tells him about the tank and then Robin sees the tank drive up into the truck. You notice it upon rereading, but if you see the top of page 6 where the tank is drawing into the truck, you see the cutout of the tank, sort of the rectangular thing. I think that's supposed to give us a clue that the truck also opens from the side. So it's lined up with other trucks so it could go out the other side. But here's my question. Doesn't the panel have to go somewhere? If the trucks are right next to each other.
Oh, yeah.
Where does that go? Unless it's cloth or something?
Yeah, and how can they open both ways? How is the room for them to both have them open at the same time?
Exactly, when they're right smack next to each other.
The back of like a U-Haul will go up into the truck, but I don't know necessarily that these would be the same way from the side, that they would fold up into the top. That's a good catch, Paul.
Yeah, I don't know how that all works. And then we get the moment of the issue. What is going on, guys? I think it's supposed to be his cape because he doesn't have his cape on, but it looks like it is elongated.
It's got a muscle tone and everything. It's as daft as, well, it's not as daft as the elongated man's nose, but he's going down the chimney because he's the elongated man. But this is, I mean, the only conclusion is that as a carny kid, Dick has access to Gingold to fool the rubes.
I actually thought it was just kind of like a thing he carries in his belt. And so if you have this fake leg that you carry in your belt, I didn't understand why he had to take his booty off attach that to the fake thing you carry in your belt. That makes it even worse because it definitely is flesh colored.
It's not yellow
where you see it. It's not yellow like his cape.
It's not cloth in the wind.
In the window, it looks like a real leg, right? In the window, it does look more fabric-y on the bottom of page six.
And now that I look at, it is supposed to be his cape because you see it tucked under his arm. So in the panel where he's hanging off the truck, he says, "Surprise, I put my best foot forward and now I've got you." Underneath that, you see his hand and his arm. Underneath that, you see a line that's drawn from his head to his arm. I think that's supposed to be the extension of his cape.
But his cape's not elastic like Superman's, is it?
Right,
Do you like the fact that you see his bare foot though, Sean? Do you, Sean?
Listeners, you're going to get a lot. Foot fetishing thing. I don't necessarily have a foot fetish, but I love it when people have a foot fetish and treat me to a foot massage. It doesn't turn me on to see a foot, but I love a foot massage. So, listeners.
So then Robin's humiliated. The truck is empty. That was a good twist, I thought. Dick is bored the next day going around on his tour until he gets out that night. And then he realizes that there's been another robbery. So somehow the tank did perform another robbery, and that's when he realizes his buddy was in on it. He goes back to the base, and this is the best art page, I think, of the story, page 9, where he confronts the guy. You get a good close-up of their two faces. The guy takes a swing at him, and then he gets a pretty good clunk, knocking the sergeant out. Then they solve the mystery. So it was entertaining. Some plot holes. Again, I don't think Jack C. Harris is Bob Rozakis, but this one was better than a number of them, so I enjoyed it.
I would say I couldn't see this story like this getting through today. The fact that, you know, pretty much every U.S. soldier in the story is a crook.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
I've said what I need to on this story. Sean, how about you?
I have said it all. Martin?
Yeah, a nifty little change of pace story. More, please.
Now, we are going to look at bat branding. And that's when we look at the other non-story pages in this issue. Now, luckily, we have, of course, the letter column. And this time, we have ads. And we're going to kick it off with Paul.
Inside front cover, we've got a Lego ad. We've all seen this a million times, this ad. Lego on comic books has got to build them to believe them. And you see this new expert builder series with the backhoe and other construction equipment that you can build. You know, I had a few when I was a kid. I didn't have very many. It was not a thing for me at this point when I was 14. But now, super cool, my 29-year-old son has a ton of Lego and is a huge collector. So I like to point out every Lego thing. So did you guys do much Lego when you were younger?
Not so. When I was a little kid, we used to build houses. When I was a kid, Lego was basically gray bases, white squares, the very occasional red square, one in a million yellow square. And then they started bringing in pre-made figures, proper roofs. And it's just all the fun went because it's like, where's the imagination? They just. But I do give you a million points for not pluralizing it to Lego.
I think that's my son's influence.
So growing up, I played with Legos when I would go like to other kids' houses, and it was always okay. But much later, I got something called Rivatron, and oh my god, I loved Rivatron. So you have to look it up on eBay. But Rivatron was cool because it was a rivet gun, and you had these plastic rivets. And you would rivet these pieces of plastic together and you could build a car, a windmill. They're fantastic. But now they were recalled because the rivets were little pieces of plastic. They actually kind of did look like candy. Now, they probably looked like licorice candy, so I didn't care about eating them at all because I wasn't dumb. Theoretically, this could get me canceled. And I almost think I might be okay with this. You know, like a lot of cool toys are not made anymore because of dumb kids. So like we don't have lawn darts anymore. Now, they were unsafe. But if you're swallowing a... I should take that back because if a baby... I don't want a baby to do it. So never mind. I'm fine with Rivatron being canceled because I don't want a baby to accidentally... But
like, I know what you mean.
If you're a 10-year-old and you're swallowing a plastic rivet, I don't know that I feel bad for you. But if you're a baby, that's horrible. So I am fine with Rivatron being canceled. But I think you can still get it on eBay, which I don't think you're supposed to. But maybe I should run to eBay right now and get
it. Sounds a bit like Meccano. Do you have Meccano in the States?
Yes, we have Meccano. I've seen that. I've never had it.
What do we have? Because I don't know what
Meccano,
that is.
Meccano, I think.
M-E-C-A-N-O, and it was basically construction set made out of little metal bits that you had screwdrivers and nuts. My brother liked it. It was far
a Rector set.
We had a Rector set, and I did have some of those, and they were fun because you get little screws and nuts, and you put the girders together, and they were pretty fun. I did have some of those.
Oh my god, I cannot believe, Paul, we should be ashamed of ourselves.
What?
We are horrible podcast hosts when it comes to bat branding, because we were at the newsstand and we forgot to say the Richie Rich count. Oh my God, I can't believe this.
I didn't even have it written down.
I do have it written down. Let me go back to my notes.
We had listeners yelling at us.
I know. Yeah, really. Okay, so there were 7 Richie Rich comics, and I think it was probably 7 because it was back to school because it was September.
Sorry, listeners. We apologize.
Richie Rich didn't have his cartoon at this time, but it made me think of that because our next ad is for the ABC Saturday morning lineup. And I am not alone when I say I love comic book ads that show off the Saturday lineups. We love that Friday night preview that they always had before the new cartoons started. To this day, I remember seeing that clip of Super Friends when they're going through like the water spillway, and then it was on the next day. I loved it. It starts off with, of course, Super Friends. Start your morning with the world's greatest Super Friends, Superman, Batman and Robin, Wonder Woman, the League of Justice faces a weekly battle with the dastardly Legion of Doom.
Yay. What's weird here is they only have Zan. How many pictures only have Zan with no Jaina?
Yeah, that is true. Then it's the all-new Plastic Man comedy adventure show. How do you like that, Max? So it's Plastic Man and his friends, Mighty Man and Yuck, the world's ugliest dog. Talk about being mean. That's mean.
His friend of ugh.
Rickety Rocket, Fang Face, and introducing Fang Puss, which is like a baby. Plastic Man is great. The other ones, I'm sure, were horrible.
Plastic Man.
All right. The next one. Next, meet Spider-Woman and her own brand new show. Yay. Then it was Scooby and Scrappy-Doo. And don't forget to watch the all-new, all-different, and exciting Escapades on ABC's Weekend Special and the Disco Dazzle of Dick Clark's American Bandstand. So I did some research, my quote-unquote research. Spider-Woman, you can watch that on Disney Plus. In fact, when Disney Plus launched November 12th, 2019, that was one of the first things I watched. Super Friends, you can get digitally. It used to be on HBO Max, but they took it off, of course.
Well, wasn't Spider-Woman voiced by Notch Landing star Joan Van Ark?
You are right, Martin. And there are some episodes of Scooby-Doo that are streaming, although that probably was released on disc. And Super Friends is all on disc. You can get that on eBay. And I've already purchased mine, so feel free to eBay away. So, listeners, you know I love Twinkies, the product. You know I love Twinkies ads. But the Superman ad, The Rescue for Twinkies, this literally has absolutely nothing to do with Twinkies. There's some spaceship and it's going super fast. They're going to hit a mountain. So Superman just tunnels through. And then after that, it just says, "Thank you, Earthman. Your atmosphere was more dangerous than we anticipated." And then some kids are like, "After that experience, you must be ready for some Hostess Twinkie snack cake." Because normally somehow the Twinkies are a lure to get the villain to stop. But this literally has absolutely nothing to do with the quote unquote plot of the ad. Martin, if you say anything against Twinkies, we're never talking again.
I don't know. Do you consider them food?
I consider them manna from heaven.
I think it's because I am severely allergic to corn syrups and triglycerides and fatty acids and phosphates and all that sort of muck. So I physically can't eat them without sort of waking up in the middle of the night and having to go to the bathroom and vomiting for a while. So
that's how most people react after eating Twinkies, Martin.
My guess is that you've never visited America because that's in our atmosphere here.
Oh, I have. I've met some lovely American folk, and it's been lovely. Lovely.
You must have like a scuba gear on. They pump that into the air here.
No, okay. I'm not Mr. My Body is a Temp. I eat all kinds of crap. At least it tastes nice, and Twinkies do not.
So we're going to move on to the center spread, which is another Saturday morning ad, but it's for CBS.
But it's exciting.
CBS was okay.
It's a better ad, though.
Oh, I don't think.
It's a double page spread, you know.
It's a double page. CBS was great because back then they had the rights to Bugs Bunny, the Warner Brothers Looney Tune, Bugs Bunny Roadrunner. So that was good. And they had Batman, which was good, what they talked about here, and Tarzan. So those Filmation shows, they were good. The rest was crap. Maybe not crap, but it wasn't great. So you start off with Mighty Mouse and Heckle and Jekyll, but they're not like the classic cartoons, the 70s versions, and they were never as good. Then Bugs Bunny Roadrunner show. And was this still when it was like an hour? It was an hour and a half of Looney Tunes in the morning. That was fantastic.
That's what I would watch.
Then it's the all-new Popeye Hour, which I kind of like Popeye. Got definitely a classic Fleischer Popeye. I love that. The new Fat Albert show, which back then was good and fine. Jason of Star Command, and that was live action. And a lot of live action Saturday morning back then. Sigmund and the Sea Monsters and the Far Out Space Nuts and stuff like that. Next is Tarzan and the Super Seven. And these were good. And I know they reused a bunch of animation all the time. But the Tarzan was great. Batman was great. The Freedom Force. And I was a drippy little kid. So at 1:30, I did watch 30 Minutes, which was the kids' news program. And I did like that.
That's good.
Yeah.
So, Martin, what kind of access to various of these American cartoons did you have when you were a kid?
Very little. Because our Saturday mornings were basically long programs, things with titles like Multicolored Swap Shop and Saturday Superstore, where it was just live studio interviews with little cartoons here and there. But usually the American cartoons like Scooby-Doo, they'd be at tea time during the week, you know, Goober and the Ghost Chasers nonsense. But I mean, when I saw these Saturday morning TV show ads in the comics, it always made the show seem absolutely magical. And then on the rare occasions that anything other than the cartoons made it over here, it was just big disappointment. I mean, my pal Richard Hango, who you've mentioned on the show because he has a letter in Batman Family, and he's from New Jersey, and he still hasn't deigned to accept your lovely invitation to come on the show. He sent me a box set of Isis a couple of years ago because we never got Isis, and it was just chronic. I managed one episode. I think I gave it the charity shop. And the comic was so much better. Yeah. I mean, is that Isis in the Freedom Force advert?
Yes, she was. Yes.
Was that a cartoon then? She became a cartoon.
Yes. Yes, that is true. Yes.
Moving on. The next is the Batcave, the letters column. And we get a almost 2-page long letter column, which is great, but only 3 letters, very long letters. Even so, we invite Michael Burkhalter. Can't say his name without thinking of Hogan's Heroes. Ed Villa and Steven Setter. If you are listening, let us know, and we'd love to have you visit the show. So anyway, Michael Burkhalter wants more Huntress, complains about the young Robin, which we've done. But then the best line is...
Wait. Let me tee this up for you, Paul. Because, Michael, we do want you on the show, but, man... You are burning with the hot, fiery passion of 1,000 fanboys when you wrote this letter. We still want you on the show. Don't be mean to us, but hit it, Paul.
He's got a serious complaint of mine about this issue is the back cover. What the hell is the Catwoman doing there?
Honestly.
Oh, keep going. No, keep going.
Sure, she was one of Batman's greatest foes in the past. In the past? This is a damned inappropriate time to put Catwoman anywhere because of the Selina Kyle subplot developing in current issues of Batman. There we have all the signs that the former Catwoman is sincerely going to live her life for the better, and on and on and on. Oh my gosh.
Michael Burkhalter, we want that fiery passion on this show. Paul was generous because I have the whole thing highlighted. If I was in charge of the Batcave, I would have read the whole thing.
Ed Villa is next. He comments that, quote, "The Unsolved Cases of the Batman was another uninspired outing in a series that ought to be laid to rest."
Ed, we love you. We love you, Ed.
On the positive side, quote, "It wasn't as silly as contrived as last issue's Private Life of Bruce Wayne disaster."
Ed, you have a head at the seat of the Wayne Garden table.
He does like Human Target and the Demon. He did suggest a plot where someone was trying to kill Christopher Chance. I thought that was an interesting idea. That would have been a good story.
As long as you don't get blood on the white suits.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Steven Setter compared Assault on Olympus to Detective Comics 397 and not favorably. And yeah. I meant to go read it and I forgot, but he did like the art.
He's completely wrong about, as I think Paul Levitz says in the reply, they've got barely anything in common, the two stories. It's the famous issue with the purple cover where the old guy's running off the cliff to try and catch his ghostly wife. It's that one. It's nothing like it.
Yeah, that's weird.
I wonder if he just wrote the wrong issue number or something.
I don't know. But his big complaint is that for $1, they could at least have a 2-page letter column.
Oh, I'm with him.
You're our kind of people.
And then you mentioned Paul's response is that, yeah, we disagree on the similarity of the stories, but hey, no hard feelings. Here's a 2-page letter column, which of course is not a full 2-page because we do get a cool ad, a third
still,
yeah, ad at the bottom of the page of that great Batman cover we mentioned in the Batman Commandy team up and Brave and the Bold at the bottom.
Oh, yes.
A fun letters page, this issue. I did enjoy it.
Our next advertising page was alluded to earlier. So it's a full page ad at the very top. What's this? Superboy leaving the Legion of Superheroes? It's a sad day as the Boy of Steel departs from the mag that was his home for 258 issues. And that's the great cover where Superboy is crying and he's flying away into the rainbow ribbon of time from the Legion of Superheroes. I've read some Legion of Superheroes. I do think I'm going to start picking them up from, what's the Legion art? Disco Legion?
Mike Grell.
Yeah, so probably from there I'll start reading it.
Yeah, there's a couple collections of those, but some of them are only collected in the showcases. So you might be able to find the showcase.
I'll get the issues. I want color. So then Superboy Superboy is flying into a happy day as he flies into the first issue of his own new magazine. So join the celebration. Both go on sale October 25th. It's a date. And I had that first issue of the new Adventures of Superboy.
I like the little Superboy flying from one panel to the other. I think that was really cute.
New Adventures of Superboy number one, Sean. What was the big thing that probably annoyed you?
Oh, is this where they spelled electrifying wrong?
Yep, electrifying.
Yeah. So that ran for a long time. I think I only need maybe like 11 more issues to complete the collection.
Oh, it's just over 50 issues. It was one of my favorite comics of the Bronze Age. Absolutely super.
Good Kurt Schaffenberger art in that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, really good. Good skips by Bob and Paul Kupferberg. That first Superboy issue, that was the one where they suddenly moved the Superboy strip ahead about 10, 15 years because previously that had been stuck in the 50s, after not in the 40s. Then they moved up to the 60s and it was great stuff. Really enjoyed it. But I don't understand why the Legion didn't get the number one.
I think probably because even though the book was Superboy and the Legion of Superheroes, it was the Legion of Superheroes. So I kind of think that's why.
As you track the history of that book, of course, it was Superboy and then Superboy with some backups of the Legion. And then there was team-ups. I mean, this was the mid to late 70s into the early 80s was peak popularity of Legion, right? And so it took over the book. So I think people collecting that book were collecting it because of the Legion at that point, probably. So they wanted to maybe start fresh with Superboy. That's the only thing I can think of, Martin.
That's the second time they knocked Superboy out of comics. They did the same thing in Adventure Comics, didn't they?
Yep, they did.
Because it used to be sort of Superboy at the front, then Legion backups. And the Legion backups started getting longer. Then the Superboy stories became reprints. And then they took over the whole magazine.
Then they moved over to Superboy's magazine because they were already there, and Venture Comics became one of its many other iterations, right? So it's an interesting history of why they did all these things. Every decision might have made sense at the time, but it is interesting to think about.
Yeah.
And then the last bit of the ad is your gateway to adventure. Now, two sensational superheroes in one sensational book. And that's when it starred Starman and Plastic Man. How do you like
Plastic
that,
Man?
And I had this issue because of Plastic Man. I didn't care at all about Starman.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, Sean, because I really like the Starman feature. And I just recently reread them, still dug it. You know, it was a story that had a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's at the beginning here. And then after Adventure switched formats again, and in a couple of years, it ended up with the DC Comics Presents storyline and Mongol and all that. I really enjoyed that.
I think now that I have my deeper appreciation for Ditko at this time, I think I'll enjoy it.
Try it again
when I reread it. Yeah,
a couple quickies. Facing page 3 of the Batgirl story, there's a DC special series ad for the soul-searing climax of the Collector's Classic. We've mentioned the Swamp Thing saga. This DC special series reprinting all the Bernie Wrightson, Len Wein Swamp Things, and then the inside back cover. So I'm asking our toy friends, Leaping Lizards. Now, I was probably too old at this point to be playing with dinosaur toys, but these look pretty cool. I did not have any of these. Did anyone? Did any of our listeners have it? It doesn't look like the kind of thing our resident toy expert Chris Franklin would have. But any comments from either you guys or any of the Bat listeners would be welcome on the Leaping Lizards.
I think I've seen those. I think they're just, if they're what I'm thinking of, they're just sort of pretty much hard-molded ones with hardly any points of movement. I mean, you can see the T-Rex's neck moves, but they're just, They're not the best, are they?
No, they're more like little statues with a couple movable parts. Yeah.
Well, it's from Monogram Models. So yeah, I think it was a model kit.
All right, well, let's move on to the highlight of the issue. The Odd Man, an 8-pager written, penciled, and inked by Steve Ditko. And it's only been reprinted in that Steve Ditko Omnibus Volume 2. It is the first and only appearance of the Odd Man. I wonder why. We open with a common jewelry fence named Ike being interrogated by a very uncommon, well, let's say odd man. The Odd Man is investigating recent thefts. The info Ike gives him leads him to another robbery in progress by a guy dressed like an Egyptian pharaoh for some reason. This guy wields a very un-Egyptian gun that encases its victim in plastic, sort of like a hardened version of Killer Moth's goo gun, I guess. Anyway, the Odd Man disarms pharaoh by using his, wait for it, a weighted extended tie, but the pharaoh gets away. He returns to his queen, dressed as Cleopatra, naturally, and hands over another of the Nile gems he has been collecting like infinity stones, so his Cleopatra can somehow be truly reincarnated. We then learn Odd Man's secret identity, Clay Stoner, a private investigator. Aha! Sean, a detective. Clay is friendly with a judge who takes him to meet another collector named Mr. Haxer. Haxer has given most of his collection to the exhibit at the museum run by a Ms. Nyla. But since she is the only woman in the story, Ms. Nyla is, of course, Cleopatra. She has Pharaoh kill Haxor when she realizes he has held back his Infinity Stone, a Nile gem. Odd Man then realizes the connection and confronts the pair. After a brief skirmish, he uses some of his odd tricks to trip up the Pharaoh, who unintentionally fires his gun at Cleopatra, encasing her in plastic, killing the woman he adores. Pharaoh is so upset by this that he turns the gun on himself, and before the Odd Man can stop him, he has joined his love in a plastic embrace for eternity. The end. Wow. Martin, what did you think of the Odd Man?
Well, I mean, as you know, this strip and the Roy Raymond entry were the reason I asked to be on this episode, because I've heard of the Odd Man. I'd seen him in the DC Explosion, I think it was, House Ad. I'd never read the story. And he didn't disappoint, because he's just bizarre. The story was daft but entertaining. Yes. I mean, the costume's great. The gimmicks are nutty. I like the fact he's called Claire Stoner, so he's presumably a druggie. But yeah, I mean, hopefully we'll be going through it page by page. We can come up with a few points. But overall, I liked it. How about you guys?
Bat Cousins, I've got a story for you. So every time I read this, I remember the visual of the Odd Man from the DC Explosion ads. Yep. Absolutely. I would have read this at the time, but I never understood what was going on, because I had never followed the Odd Man in all of his previous, you know, appearances. That's why I didn't know what was going on. So it so I never completely connected, but that was fine, because I was late coming. So I read the first page of this and I thought, you know what? I don't really know a lot about the Odd Man. I'm going to look up his Who's Who entry. So I went to look up his Who's Who's entry, and he doesn't have one. And I'm like, well, no, that's... So something's wrong. I'm doing this wrong, because I know every DC character with, I think, two or three appearances, has a Who's Who page. So I have to be doing this wrong. So I tried it again. And I'm like, well, that's weird. I'll look him up on Mike's Amazing World of Comics, because they have a character guide. The odd thing was, there was no character. I'm like, what is going on? So I looked in DC fandom. So he only had three appearances, and they're like 20 and 30 years apart. So now it makes sense. And now I'm doubly impressed that Steve Ditko wrote this. I know he was going to be in Shade, the Changing Man, but still, Steve Ditko decides the Odd Man's first appearance. But I'm not going to tell you like how he developed this stuff.
Why he sits in a room that's upside down.
Does it. So now I absolutely love this story, because I can't believe, I don't know if I want to say the gall, because that sounds like rude, the hubris, ego, maturity, that Steve Ditko is going to like, I'm going to write this. I don't know if it's going to appear anywhere. I'm not going to tell you anything about it. It's going to happen. I did like this story a lot, and I love that whole backstory about it. I thought I was the Odd Man now, because I never read any Odd Man stories before. No, this is it. This is the first one.
I liked it too. It's fun. I like the Ditko art, not as much as I like the Demon, but I did like it overall. Ditko's got a lot going on. He's got the Micronauts annual out. He's got Prince Gavin Starman. I think Shade is done by now, though, Sean. I would pass Shade, but again, I say, why?
Yep.
You know, I don't know. But let's go through. So you start off in a very odd way.
You don't know why, and you'll never find out why.
We'll never know. We'll never know. And I love the first page where you've got the Odd Man sitting on a desk, but he's upside down. And then a guy is hanging from a window, but not the same vertical. You don't know whether it's real or hallucinogenic. I think it's intended to be hallucinogenic, but a striking first page.
Oh, it's just fantastic. I mean, it gets your attention and you're dying to turn the page over to see how he is doing this, and you never find out, as you say.
You never will.
And it's, look, listeners, we'll probably put a couple of pages of this in there, but the Odd Man, he's really weird looking. He's got this plasticky face that we find out is a full face mask later on, which I dig that for sure. The plastic gun, it looks like a hairdryer.
Yeah,
which is fantastic. The image of the figure at the bottom of page 2, how he's encased in the plastic.
Yeah.
And this is pretty dark. It's not like the net that Baron Time threw over Jason Blood. Talked about how we like the look of that. And I like the look of this, not quite as much, but it still looks pretty cool. But this is hard plastic, and the guy has suffocated and been killed inside. This villain is going around doing this to a bunch of people. And then the Odd Man knocks the gun out of his hand with his tie. So let's talk about that.
Fucking
Love it. It's a perfect time to test out my weighted extended tie. Bingo, he knocks it out. He's got like bolo weight at the end or something.
I will admit, I am not a fan of clip-on ties. I hate them. I think they're horrible. In this case, I will allow it because it is fantastic.
But it's not the perfect time. The perfect time is to do it before you start off on an adventure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What do you think his Mickey Mouse gloves can do then?
Oh, well, he does puts his hands together and it has the poofy cloud. Oh, the very last page on page 8. Now, if my powder and smoke gloves work.
Oh, how did I forget that? I apologize. Yeah.
Oh, I'm an expert on the odd man now.
That's fantastic.
Look at his headquarters. He's rushing out and his headquarters has upside down. So I thought you'd like him too because he sticks to his theme, Sean, because his headquarters.
Yeah.
See, that's where it's real because it's not hallucinogenic there because he's got an upside down table and a door that's sideways and a chair that's sideways. It took a lot of effort to like glue all these things to the walls and the ceiling.
But I was wondering because it's Steve Ditko also gave us, as we were talking, Shade the Changing Man, and Shade could make people see the world in funny ways. And I wonder whether this was like the inverse of that, in that this was how the old man sees the world.
Well, that's brilliant, Martin.
He'd never be able to hit anybody though, would he?
Maybe when he puts on that mask, this is what he sees.
It could be, yeah. But I do think they missed a trick on though by not making this farewell villain King Tut, because that would again straight into the area of Batman family.
Yeah, really.
And also so much better than Maxie's use.
I like how they then force him into the sarcophagus rather than just plasticking him. They force him into the sarcophagus, which they then plastic together. And he just does a spray that melts the plastic somehow, so he gets out of the sarcophagus, which is neat. So then she's acquired all the gems at the bottom, and then he comes in. And then the end is pretty dark as well. It's pretty grim.
And very cursory.
Yeah. The Pharaoh trips on the oily spray that the odd man sprays on the ground. Another one of his gadgets. He trips, and he's firing the gun, and he hits Cleopatra, and she's encased in plastic. And he goes, oh, no, I've killed the woman I love. And he just, boom, turns the gun on himself and encases himself in plastic. I'm like, whoa.
So endeth the miniskirt twins.
Yeah, really? Wow.
Who's the colorist?
Color Gene D'Angelo.
Okay, so Gene props up because you colored it correctly. You can see his hands aren't in the plastic, but he is because he turned the gun on himself.
Right. That's right. Ooh, that's even creepier. Yeah, I don't know. I really enjoyed this. I mean, I knew it was in here, but I didn't really remember the story until 2 weeks ago when I read it again.
Oh, it was fun.
And I was like, wow, that was different. That was odd.
But did either of you understand the logic of the man who had the jewels, Emil Haxa, the famous collector, in that he says, no one will try to steal the jewels he owns from the museum because he's donated them. Why would a thief care who you're stealing from?
I think his thinking is, if they're in a museum, they're much more safe than at my house.
Or they won't kill me. They'll kill some schlep security guard who wants to look at the Italian stuff.
And also, my other question was, on page 6, Claire muses out loud that the odd man should be the one to question the subtly named secret reincarnated Egyptian queen / nutter, Mrs. Nyla. So does Judge Brass know his secret ID, or should that be a thought balloon?
I think the judge knows his secret ID, but it's not clear. I agree with you.
Yeah, and Ditko likes judges, because didn't he have a judge being the dad of Hawk and Dove?
Yes, he was the father in Hawk and Dove, and he does like having somebody for the character to talk to, you know? Batman's got his Alfred, and now many, many other people, but I get that. Nice to have a confidant.
Yeah, and do you think this really was Cleopatra coming at you?
Oh, Martin, I love you and no one else gets that. So there was a British pop group called Cleopatra and that was like in one of their songs. Love you, Martin.
You guys crack me up.
I wonder if Jack C. Harris suggested this to Paul Levitz as a filler, because Jack C. Harris had been editing Shade the Changing Man, and obviously he would have been left with this in a drawer when it was cancelled before issue 9 came out, I think.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, maybe. We know Levitz has given Ditko a lot of work. I think he was a fan. I could see Levitz saying, you want to do a new feature? Go for it.
Yeah, but it was already created before Levitz came to Batman Family. Anyway, it was left over.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. This is another inventory.
It's a holdover. Yeah.
No, you're right. I don't know.
I'm so happy it's in here now. It took me... I'm horrible at math. So what's 2024 minus 1979, whatever, however many years that is.
45 years.
45 years. I'm glad I finally came around to the odd man. I love it.
That was fun. Surprise of the issue for me. So
I agree. I think this might be the surprise of the series for me.
Absolutely. Since you mentioned those other appearances, Sean, do you want to mention where they were?
Oh, Martin, why are you calling me out in public on this? Oh, man. So one of them was a Superboy, I think from 96?
Yeah, it was one of those crowds where lots of heroes turn out to try and get a job with Project Cadmus.
Okay. And then I forget what the other one
it was. It was just a few years ago in an appalling DC comic called Mother Panic, which was set in Gotham. So again, we have Gotham links, but he was in that? Yeah.
I read the first couple issues of that and gave up on it.
Yeah, there was a backup, Paul, from about issue 4 or 5, ran 3 issues. And he's in that. He's more the old man than the odd man because his daughter's in that. He's this old guy who's thinking of going back to work as the odd man. And it's, have a little look on the DC app. Don't buy it, for God's sake.
All right. I'll have to check that out because I'm curious now.
But it is funny. First of all, I can't believe we've talked about the odd man this much, and I'm going to talk even more. But we talk about the ads, but that just goes to show the odd man was in that DC Explosion ad, which probably was in like 3 months, maybe
yep. 4.
Like that goes to show the power of comic book advertising, because I definitely thought he was much more of a big deal than what he is. Mm. But probably because of that ad.
Yeah, because he stuck in all our minds as a mystery all those years. Who was the odd man?
Yeah.
We still don't know.
That's true. Best owner.
Okay. Nothing can live up to the odd man, but we're going to give it the old college try. The next story, the last story, is Batgirl in the Case of the Campaign Crimes. It is 10 pages, written by Jack C. Harris, penciled by Dick Giordano, inked by Steve Mitchell, and it was later reprinted in Batgirl, the Bronze Age Omnibus, Volume 2 hardcover from 2019. Batgirl in the Case of the Campaign Crimes. Our story begins with a rollicking action scene as Batgirl swings her way through the city and runs into a TV station. Tackling a cameraman, BG prevents the assassination of Barbara Gordon's political rival, Della Ziegler. Dashing back into the studio after changing, Babs debates Della on the issue of crime, specifically organized crime. Watching these debates closely is Mr. Doyle, who we find out was behind the cameraman hitman plot. Now that that sharpshooter has been taken into custody, he's talking to Hicks, the next best marksman. We see another assassination attempt, but we're not sure if it's meant for Ziegler or Gordon, but we do know that Gordon is Batgirl, and she goes after the shooter that tried to shoot her. Confronting Hicks, Batgirl is left with a case of shoulder ache, and Hicks gets away. A car ride with Commissioner Gordon triggers Babs' eidetic memory, and she realizes that Roger Doyle, Della's campaign manager, is really Gary Chase, a former mobster. BG goes on a multi-day bender, bringing in as many criminals as Dole/Chase can name, ultimately letting Doyle know that she's bringing him in next. Our story concludes on election night, but ends on a cliffhanger as to whether or not Barbara is going to be a congresswoman in the next issue. What did you guys think, Martin?
Well, the title puts me off. The Case of the Campaign Crimes. I mean, politics, yuck. But it turns out, again, a bit of a change of pace. We don't have a wacky one-off supervillain with no name. It's interesting that it's moving Babs to a bold new direction. Without going into the details, I thought it was a good little chapter.
I liked it. The art is beautiful. You know, I love Dick Giordano. And I think Steve Mitchell did a pretty good job on his pencils. Nice moments that I'll point out. You know, the story is a way to get us to, like you just said, Martin, a new direction for Babs coming up. Spoiler alert. Not a classic, but it was fun.
I definitely liked it more than Paul seems to like it. Loved the beginning, like the action sequence.
Yeah, the beginning's great.
And I actually thought this time the political background really works in the favor of the story. Because sometimes these politics stories aren't great for like a comic book story. But this time I thought it was. It's like a cool, I don't know necessarily that's a cliffhanger, but yeah, a small hill cliffhanger. Mm-hmm. But I liked it. Not the best story of the issue, because we know nothing can ever top the odd man now. But I liked it. So we get Batgirl swinging in. The very first page, she's swinging above this minivan. Della's our delegate. But you can tell. So if you grew up in the 70s, you know this is Bella Abzug.
I was going to ask, because it's so specific. I was thinking, she looks a bit like Auntie Mame or someone. But the name, oh, thank you. Who's Bella Abzug? A politician?
Yeah, she was a politician. And she definitely was known for her hats. And even back in the 70s, women politicians were still a fairly new thing. She got a lot of press and publicity. And I think she was very good at mining the press for publicity.
Yeah. Della.
One thing thing I'm going to say, though, with Paul, I'll disagree just a little bit. I love Dick Giordano art, and I think his women look absolutely beautiful and fantastic. Dick Giordano, I would say, is a 10 as an artist. And this art maybe was like an 8 for me. And I wasn't sure if it was Steve Mitchell or...
Faces are not as pretty, for lack of a better word, with Steve Mitchell inking. I agree with you. It's better for him to ink himself. I agree with you 100%. But the actions, I mean, look at page 2, for example.
Yeah,
page 2 is great. Yeah. I mean, you've got bad girl swinging in, and then the top right corner, that panel where she's running in, that's just fabulous. And then where she's dashing into the studio with her cape flowing behind her. I don't know. I just think it's great.
Absolutely. And that splash page, the way that Babs is swinging in with one leg straight out, the other leg bent.
Yeah.
And you can see he's drawn in the line of the rope swing. Mitchell flattens out. I think he's got quite a bit George Ellis type flattening line, but it's still Dick Giordano, so it's not bad by any means.
Yeah.
And again, I love Giordano, but look at the woman who's looking up at Batgirl. She kind of looks like a mannequin.
Yeah.
So is that Dick Giordano or is that Steve Mitchell?
Again, I don't think he's as adept at the facial features, but I think the figure line work, I think he does well. But I hear you. I agree. It's not as good. I'm not going to argue with you.
So on page 3, so that is a great Batgirl figure where she's twisting the cape from the skirt to the cape. We always love that.
The way the cowl's hanging down against the hair.
That's really cool.
Yeah, I do like brilliant. That. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, that is clever. I like that.
And too. I like that the TV studio, like you really see the layout of the studio when they're debating. Now, this part I just found really interesting, how they're debating crime. Babs is saying organized crime is bad, and Della is saying it's more born from poverty. They're both right. I don't understand.
Why are they debating? Babs should be fighting crime on both fronts.
Yeah, exactly.
My bullet on this one says, page 4, not sure I get the argument. Both have a point.
Yep. I same note, 3 of us for 3.
But then you see the true villain and he's watching the debates. And it is nice because all the way through the story, you are like, oh, are they going after Babs? Are they going after Della? Which one are they going after? Yeah, I think that is set up really, really well. Nothing is tipped away. Nothing's cheated. You see Babs saying, so you think you were the target? And like right underneath her balloon saying yes, you see him putting together the rifle. So man, it's making you think that.
But I think it's great that Della isn't, you know, because normally if a politician opposing Babs, they would automatically be bad, shady at the very least. And she just seemed like, you know, a good woman.
Exactly. They didn't make her bad, right. Mm-hmm.
And I would say this is maybe one time where reading it on DC Universe Infinite might be just a little bit better, because I do think where you see the sights and you see Babs and Della and you do see right in the middle, but because of the coloring, he really, really fades into the background where you kind of like can't really see him. And on DC Universe...
Oh, yes, didn't see him.
Wait, what are you talking about? What page?
Okay, so on story page 5, so you have the panels of where he's assembling the gun. Right underneath that round panel where it's supposed to be the sights.
Yeah.
The gun. So you see Babs and then you see Della, and in between them you do see him, but it's all colored the same as the background.
You're so right, I didn't notice that.
But on DC Universe Infinite, it's a little bit more noticeable. Pronounced? Yeah.
I'm just going to that now to have a little look.
But it is neat because then after the shot rings out, then Babs leaps up for a fire escape and she says, no time to be careful with my new dress.
I love
stuff like that. Yeah. And then she's going after the assassin, which, by the way, on page 6, panel 4, he kind of looks like Ted Danson.
He does look like Ted Danson.
That's true. I love Babs' shirt. That's because she's been hanging out with Clark Kent a lot, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It's that Kent influence. He hits her in the shoulder with the attaché case. That would hurt. That absolutely
would very much hurt. That would dislocate her.
Now, the next part is a little disappointing because she's riding with Commissioner Gordon and they're talking back and forth. But then he says, I hope you can manage both Babs's career as well as Batgirl's. Hey, and so that makes her think of the manager. So this was written by Jaxie Harris. And then in the Robin story, it's kind of like the exact same thing where he's fighting with the soldier and the soldier says, I'll knock you sideways, you turkey.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Robin says, no way, but thanks for reminding me of something.
Yeah, you're right. That's
a good point, Sure, they're good listeners. Actually, I suppose this was one of those alternate weeks when Commissioner Gordon knew her identity. Actually, bottom of page 7, her hair seems to vanish.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Yeah, that's not right. I didn't notice that.
So then she goes in after him because...
And I can buy the fact that she recognized him from mugshots because of that eidetic memory. So yeah, I buy
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And he is wearing a hairpiece. So, mm-hmm. like, and I will say, people talk about the Clark Kent glasses throwing people off and how dumb that is. But I will say, I worked backstage at a local community theater. So in Lancaster, there's the Fulton Theater. And I worked backstage on two shows. And I would talk with especially like actresses. And they were done up in period hair.
Yeah.
And then I would be out at market. And this woman would come up and say, hey, Sean, I'll see you later. And I'm, hey, yeah, okay. And I'd be like, oh, God, I have no idea who that woman is. And then later that night, it would be like, oh, what did you get at market? Oh, that's who that was. If someone has different hair, it can throw me off.
Yeah, true.
I'm fine with this happening with Babs.
Talking of disguises, going back to page 3, the page on which Babs is putting on her Sunday clothes, at the bottom panel there where they're having the debate, they seem to have the wrong pointers on the word balloons.
Yes.
You're right.
Gary Chase, the former mobster. It is funny because I was using the campaign to get close to Congresswoman Gordon. I figured she could get me FBI protection. Why wouldn't you just go to the FBI and say, you know, I have this information? Why do you have to get close to Barbara Gordon?
I've seen Alias. You can walk into the office. They have big round blobs on the floor. Just ask.
So then with the information that she gets from the mob informant, Babs is going to get all these criminals. So much so, she kind of ignores and forgets that she's up for re-election. That's kind of... Yeah.
That's a bit difficult to believe.
I was thinking about that, Sean, and my theory is they wanted her to lose so that she'd come back to Gotham, right? That bold new direction. But they didn't want to just show her losing because that would imply something. Maybe she was bad or whatever. So they had to say that her greater calling was being Batgirl, and therefore she was doing all this and neglecting her campaign, which allowed this other person to win. My own theory, I have no
idea. That makes sense, yeah.
So then you see Doyle, the guy who hired the hitman, he's looking in his bathroom mirror and there's a note from Batgirl. I love stuff like that. That's fantastic.
That is good.
Then the last couple panels is where she's seeing that the results are coming in and is she going to win? Kind of on a personal note, when we do the letters page, we always invite the letter writers. Technically, I had this issue on the stands, but my copy was messed up, so I bought another one off of eBay. And at the bottom of the last page, Michael McNamara wrote his on this issue. So Michael McNamara, if you are listening, please let us know. We'd love to have you on the show because you wrote your name on the last page of my issue. Thank you for putting it up on eBay or however.
I thought you were going to ask Bella to come on. Well, actually, one little last thing on that story, and it probably just bothered me. Panel 2, page 9, after she learned that Long Arm's Law could not reach them, they learned that the converse is true. Why would he put converse rather than reverse? Strange, because they don't have the same, exact same meaning.
Product placement?
Could be, yeah. Babs's boots are converse. I like this story, and I would say that, you know, Babs does deserve to lose.
Yeah, well, I think that's, again, they want you to come around. I mean, she's been in Congress. Her 2-year term has lasted, what, 8 or 9 years at this point? So it's hard to disagree with. It's time to bring her back to Gotham, I think.
Yeah, no, it was a weird job in the first place.
Yeah.
When they wrote her going into Congress, it's the whole relevancy, Green Arrow, Green Lantern, and that kind of thing. And then it was kind of like getting away from that a little bit.
Yeah, and it was giving her something different. It was different. And it was... Cleverly utilized in some stories and sillily utilized in other stories. So she can't lasso the top of the Washington Monument anymore, but there are plenty of places for her to swing around in Gotham.
Yeah, but yeah, you're right.
I think we're spoiling next issue there. So maybe we should step away from this topic. We still don't know whether she's won or lost.
Speaking of swinging, we're going to go from swing dancing to disco dancing because we are going to take a trip to Gabriel's Horn, the hip happening hangout for the Teen Titans in the 1970s. We're going to talk about the most 1970s, 79 moments in this issue from any of the stories. Martin, let's start with you.
In the Batman story, yeah, in the pose of Sergius, where we came up in the story discussion, where anyway, Batman tells the League of Assassins duo, but you goofed, no teenager has worn pedal pushers in years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the reference to pedal pushers, I mean, even then that was probably completely out of time.
Sean, about you? What do you have in Batman?
Yes, so I have two that are one that's good and one that's fantastic. Although the fantastic one is in reverse. So you see a typewriter, like how the writer's using typewriter. Although people still use typewriters. Yeah. I guess
that still counts.
Tom Hanks is big for using a typewriter. So that's fine. Yeah. The newspaper, but specifically the personals column.
Classified ad, yep.
Even back then during its heyday, always seemed like such an inefficient way to contact people or talk to people.
Always coming up in Batman stories in the olden days, wasn't he? Didn't Bruce Wayne used to get all the newspapers of the world?
Yes, I remember reading that. Yeah.
The small ads and things.
The only newspaper that's worth it is the Underworld Star. That's the only one that's worth it. The All Night Classic Movie Theater. I definitely think that was a thing in New York City at the time. I doubt that that's still Bat Cousins. If you live in New York and there are still All Night Classic Movie houses, let us know.
We still have one in London.
Do you really?
Yep.
Wow.
Certainly a few years ago, but I don't know whether it's still there. Certainly I've been to it, yeah.
That is fascinating to me.
Yeah, in King's Cross area.
So now the next one is, well, it's straight up cheating because it's not really a 70s reference. Sergius is out jogging. I don't know if this is fair because technically Walkmans weren't invented, but you can tell Walkmans weren't invented because if he'd be jogging with a Walkman, you would see him jogging with a Walkman, but there wasn't a Walkman. So that places it as 1979.
I had that too, but for a different reason. I had the jogging sort of craze started in the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Where people did it and jogging suits like he's wearing and that sort of stuff. I think it's not only the 70s, but kind of started the 70s.
Yeah, I don't know whether we should allow that. Sure. Okay. The absence of something that's invented later, you could apply that to anything. You could, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
Fair enough.
Why didn't Babs use a cell phone? Yeah, that's true.
The only other small one I had was the TV antenna that's floating around in the water at the last page. Is a big antenna on the TV. So there's some stuff like that. The phone's on the wall. So there's some period placement there. But that's all. I didn't really have anything much in that either.
Martin, did you have anything for Roy Raymond, TV detective?
I didn't because it was perfection.
The only one I had, Sean, was Morgan Ed's cigarette.
Oh, yeah.
You got one of those long cigarettes.
I didn't really find anything, but yours are very good. Martin, we're going to move on to the Iron Solution. What did you have?
I've got a couple, and you know, feel free to shoot me down for being mean to you. So yeah, the African-American army guy swinging his gun at the boy wonder, or the teen wonder, or the man wonder, and yelling, "I'll knock you sideways, you turkey."
turkey.
And then the other one I've got, my final one for the issue, someone says, "You try living with the devaluation of the dollar these days."
That's a great one.
And that would took me right back.
Well, but I don't know, because it kind of seems timely now.
You got me.
My best one, probably for the issue, is this story takes place in West Germany.
Oh my gosh, brilliant. Yeah.
Yes, well done.
Oh, geez. I do have two other ones, but that one is the best one. And when Dick Grayson goes into his meeting, there are ashtrays on the business table.
Yes, absolutely.
My next one is a little bit more questioning. On story page 8, he goes into the designer's room and everyone's on drafting tables. Do they still use drafting tables?
I don't know, but it's a good observation.
And the odd man, I don't have any because that is perfection and timeless and will outlive all of us.
Once again, Ditko's stuff is so weird that we find very little. I have nothing in the odd man.
Yeah. Martin, anything in Batgirl?
Not really. I mean, it all looks so 70s to me anyway that there was nothing specifically that stuck out.
No, all I have is TV equipment, the television itself, just the kind of equipment that they have, all the newspapers, the newsstand, but nothing that we haven't seen in other stories. How about you, Sean? Did you have anything?
Yes. Well, so Bella Abzug, definitely. The other two things are a 20-cent newspaper.
You're right. Good one.
This does not hold up because 20 cents in 1979 is worth 90 cents today. The newspapers are not 90 cents. For a regular newspaper, it's like $1.50, $2.
Good one, though, Sean.
The other thing, which happens twice in the story, I'm going to say TV, and that makes sense, these big boxes of a TV.
Yeah.
But it's the placement of the TV. The TVs are on the floor.
TVs
are never on the floor now.
Yeah.
Like they used to be like, you know, huge cabinet display things.
You're right. It's a couple times in the story. Yeah.
And now they're never on the floor.
Yeah, that's a good one. Wow. Well done. That's it. I don't have anything else. You guys?
That's it.
Nothing from me, no.
That about wraps it up for the issue. Martin, once again, thank you for your repeat occurrence. Do you have any other appearances you want to plug or anywhere that people can reach you on the internet?
Podcast-wise, I'm quite often on Billy D's Brave and the Bob podcast. I've got my blog, Too Dangerous for a Girl.
Which is fabulous, by the way.
Thank you for your kind. Thank you, thank you. And find me on Twitter at March Gray or at Danger Mart. Generally making tiny little comments in the Batman Family Reunion comments section.
Tiny little comments, right?
I know. Verbal diary. What can you do? But thank you so much for having me on. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you again. Hopefully you'll have me on the Superman Family podcast. Oh.
Spoiler, no. I can make a solemn promise to all of my Bat cousins. There will be an Odd Man podcast before there will be Superman Family Values, Family Ties.
Well, I can't wait to hear what everybody else thinks of the Odd Man.
Thank you again, Martin. Now we are going to play a podcast promo. And when we return, we will read and respond to your listener feedback.
I am vengeance. I am the knight. I am Batman!
You need to take out the trash.
I don't have time for that now. We have two podcasts I have to create a new promo for.
What? Both JLU Cast and Supermates?
Yes. JLU Cast, where you and I discussed the Justice League and Justice League Unlimited animated series from Bruce Timm and Company.
And Supermates, our original show where we talk about all sorts of geeky stuff, including our annual House of Frankenstein series on classic horror films. Yeah.
That's it. But how do we combine this into one promo?
I have no idea, but it sounds like we're doing our original Supermates promo all over again.
I kind of think we are, but hey, other folks kind of aped it, so it must have worked.
Well, why don't you get to work taking out the trash, and I'll finish up.
Great.
So join us, Cindy.
And Chris.
On JLU Cast and Supermates, both proudly part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, found at fireandwaterpodcast.com and on iTunes.
Welcome back. Now we're going to read and respond to your listener feedback to episode 486, Skeletons, Sea Devils, and Stamp Collections with our special guest, first-time podcaster Dan Dockney. First up, our favorite bat nephew Isamu says, maybe Alfred is John Steed in Witless Relocation. I understood that reference, Uncle Sean. While looking for a Marvel's Avengers movies Blu-ray a few months ago, I came across my dad's DVD box set of the Avengers, the Emma Peel mega set, and I've been watching a few episodes a week. The show is fun and quite funny, though a lot of the scenes do seem to lag compared to shows today. What was also fun was seeing a young Alfred Pennyworth, Michael Gow from the 1989 Batman movie, playing two different over-the-top villains on the show. Great stuff.
So I watched the Avengers when it was on CBS on Friday nights at 11:30. Which is well past its run. But it was really the first time I saw a detective show that had flirty bantering. It was probably 5-10 years before Moonlighting, before Scarecrow and Mrs. King, Heart to Heart, all of those shows. You had The Thin Man from decades before and stuff like that. But yeah, for me, it was the first time really seeing that flirty banter and Britishness. Yeah, I love all of that.
Back to Isamu, who then goes on to school us on the history of Killer Moth. He says, I first encountered Killer Moth in the Teen Titans cartoon, where he looked like a half-man, half-moth monster. And I was intrigued by the comic book version when you covered Batman Family number 15, where I saw that Killer Moth was wearing his mask in a jail cell. Was that his actual face? So I Googled Killer Moth's appearances in DC Comics and then went through Dad's long boxes to read all the stories. And I discovered that Killer Moth did start his costume career in Batman number 63 as a, quote, crime protector who studied Batman's methods that were publicly known in order to aid crooks in the same way Batman would aid the police. He was once a crook who served his time in prison and stashed enough stolen loot from his earlier crimes to set himself up as a millionaire named Cameron Van Clear. He hired people to construct a cave under his mansion, as well as build a mothmobile and likely his other devices, and promptly killed those people when they were done in order to maintain his secret, just like in the Batgirl story. Killer Moth gave a bunch of Gotham crooks a flashlight that was actually a handheld infrared moth signal, which he could see with a special lens, instructing them to shine it in the sky to summon him if they run into trouble during a crime. Back then, Killer Moth charged 2/3 of the stolen loot for his crime protection services. So in this Batgirl story, he marked down his fee to half, likely to drum up some new business. Oh, and the mask wasn't his real face. And listeners, let me say, Isamu posted scans of various panels from Killer Moth appearances throughout Batman's career. Wow. Above and beyond, Isamu, as usual. Thanks. It was really great.
I left a comment. When we started the Batman Family Reunion, I knew that we would be providing delicious food for all of our Bat cousins. I didn't know that we would be providing rich, detailed history of the creators and the characters. Thank you. Professor Isamu.
There you go. I have to say, we probably also owe Jack C. Harris an apology. We were really making fun of the crime protector and the moth signal, and they were all there from before. His behavior was very consistent to his prior appearances. So, Jack C. Harris, good on you, buddy.
And Isamu finishes up with, I didn't find the bare feet in the jail cell scene in Detective 486 confusing. The story set up that Killer Moth hired the Shoemaker father to create shoes with a hollow compartment. Killer Moth would then place a signal device in the compartment and give the shoes to crooks to wear during their crimes so that they can signal Killer Moth when they need help, replacing the bulky and obviously outdated Moth signal flashlight. I'd like to think the crooks had to click their heels together three times to summon him. Killer Moth killed the Shoemaker so he couldn't be tied to his operations, although using his alias of Van Clear to hire him still made the connection. Dope! So Batgirl figured out that the signal shoes had them taken away from the Bolton gang members arrested on page 6. So one, they couldn't call Killer Moth and break them out of jail. And two, Batgirl can wear the shoes with her disguise to pretend to be another Bolton gang member summoning Killer Moth in her sting operation on pages 7 and 8. But I can understand how some readers may be confused, Uncle Sean. Maybe DC Comics will release a 12-issue miniseries called Crisis on Infinite Brannock Devices to make it more comprehensible. Sorry, Uncle Sean, I couldn't resist. Thanks, Isamu. Next up, Bat Cousin and past guest Martin Menza says, back in the day when this one hit my mailbox, I remember enjoying it, in part because of the use of three costumed villains, Maxi Zeus, Killer Moth, and Scarecrow. I always enjoyed Bat Tales when they featured the wild members of the Rogues Gallery. I was not a huge George Tuska fan in the main comics themselves, but I very much did enjoy the World's Greatest Superheroes comic strip and its Superman follow-up. I clipped every one of those strips from the morning newspaper that my grandmother got and had them in my collection for many years. Wow. Sadly, now gone. I did make a collage years later from the Color Sunday strips, though. My father managed to save it when my parents moved from my childhood home and presented it to me framed as a Christmas present in the late 90s. I still have that hanging on the wall in my man cave today. And Martin, we need to see that.
Yes.
Take the photo, post it on Twitter or in the comments. We want to see that. Thank you for sharing that, Martin.
Yeah, that was great, Martin. Next up, Network All-Star and noted film historian, our Bat Cousin Rob Kelly chimes in. I like the idea of a moth signal, but it would probably have been easier to cheaper just to hang a sweater out the window. Sean's talk about dollar comics, which could be a drinking game, but it would lead to alcohol poisoning before you ever get the feedback, makes me wish DC had taken one of their horror anthologies, like Unexpected, House of Mystery, House of Secrets, which all basically feature the same content, and devoted it to their mystery superheroes. How cool would a dollar comic have been starring Swamp Thing, the Phantom Stranger, Black Orchid, the Demon, and Madame Xanadu have been? I really like that idea. They did a little bit of that. There were some of the Unexpected did have Madame Xanadu in. I was on a Madame Xanadu kick a few years ago, and there's like 4 or 5 issues of Unexpected have her in it. But back to Rob. George Tuska was one of those great Golden Age artists who did superb work, but then got assigned fill-ins on superhero titles that were not his forte. He kept getting slotted in on JLA for Chuck Patton, 3 Tomahawks, and I really hated it, especially when it had George Perez covers, which ultimately wasn't fair to him since he excelled at comics, just not at the genres that were in favor at the time. We then got a quick comment from the other Rob, Bat Cousin Rob McCarthy, who really likes Maxi Zeus. Think about how rare it is in superhero stories for what should be a delusion to actually be a delusion. Usually he'd develop powers or something, but he'd just be crazy. Absolutely, Rob. And then Bucky 749 told us how his cousin Jeremy injured his leg fighting Plowboy.
Next up, Robert J. Smith, who is the author of the Petectives mysteries. And they seem really cool. Now, honestly, I haven't ordered them yet, but they are Fair Play mysteries. We know. I love that. It's a series of 5. The first one is Petectives. The next one is Christmas Party, Petectives Under Fire, Petectives Stalking Horse, Petectives Rainbow Bridge. So that's kind of cool. So I guess you could check them out on Kindle or the book series. It's not a paid advertisement. I'm just talking about them. He goes on to tell us, Batman telling Alfred not to be dense reminds me of a scene in Night of the Reaper where Batman condescendingly says to Robin, "Don't be stupid, kid." Denny O'Neil's Batman was way ahead of the curve when it came to being a Robin's secret identity first name. Bat Cousin and podcasting all-star Chris Franklin agrees. Regarding Batman being mean to Alfred, Denny could occasionally have Batman get snippy with his family. Robert J. Smith beat me to the punch regarding the classic Night of the Reaper from Batman 237. But I had to mention it since this stood out to me since I read the story reprinted in that classic Batman Family issue of the Best of DC Blue Ribbon Digest. Denny's 70s Batman had a bit of Clint Eastwood, Dirty Harry in him, snipping at those around him if he thought they were being, well, dense. Next up, Bat Cousin and future guest Brian Schufo says, "Hello, Bat Family Cousins. I brought a pack of Slim Jims to the party because sometimes you need some gluten-free protein late at night while wandering the dark streets of Gotham when the only thing open are the shops that sell individual cigarettes." Batman undressing while in a battle unlocked this core memory. I had an old comic in my collection whose cover fell off long before it was ever passed down to me by my older brothers, which featured Clark Kent being attacked by a robot. But for reasons I never found out, Clark Kent didn't have any of his Superman powers until every last piece of Clark Kent clothes were removed, and it took at least a full page. He should take disrobing lessons from Batman. An image of bloody knuckles, of course drawn by Kurt Swan and most likely inked by Murphy Anderson, is embedded in my brain. Does anyone remember the issue or what was going on? Isamu says, "Yes, that scene was in Superman 296, Who Took the Super Out of Superman. An alien enemy, who posed as Clark Kent's neighbor, treated Clark Kent's entire wardrobe with an unearthly chemical that counteracted yellow sun rays, pretty much negating Superman's powers while he wore them." This entire story is from Superman 296 to 299, which then our guest from this very episode, dirty-minded Bat Cousin Martin Gray, says, "Yes, that was the storyline in which Lois and Clark did it. Eat beef bourguignon, I mean, obviously." And now let me interject quickly. So when I read about how Superman had to strip off all of his clothes before he could fight, I went and looked at that issue. He had to strip off all of his Clark Kent clothes, but still had a Superman outfit on. Now, I'm not prepared to say I was tomahawked, but man, in my mind, and I understand it was a comic of the 70s, but in my mind, it was not. He just jumps down to his Superman outfit.
Back on track, Chris Franklin also added, "Great spotlight on George Tuscopaw. Thanks, Chris. I'm more of a Tusca guy than a Don Heck guy, but by the time I was encountering him, he was a journeyman comics artist. It wasn't until I started reading comics history and that I read that many creators, such as Carmine Infantino and Pete Morosi, the Thunderbolt, praise him as a huge inspiration to them. His work on Captain America over Jack Kirby's layouts in the 60s popped up on screen in the Marvel Superheroes cartoon with very limited animation. And I particularly remember the Greymore Castle saga he drew. Tuska always gave characters big uniteeth veneers. See Alfred stroking his chin on page 2. If it was a bad guy, they'd often have a big chip out of the middle. That and the splayed bodies always stood out. I've grown to appreciate his art more as I've gotten older. Looks like that bonker Wonder Woman hostess ad was indeed drawn by Kurt Swan, who did do most of those DC hostess output. Fun episode. Welcome to podcasting, Dan. Oh, one more addendum. Corgi actually made a die-cast Mothmobile about a decade ago. And OMG, listeners, the picture of the Mothmobile that Chris posted. Wow. Yeah. Chris, that made my day. It is. Yeah. You've got to go look at it, listeners. It is fantastic.
It's great.
Next up, our Bat Cousin Eric added another highly enjoyable episode. Hearing the anecdote about George Tuska punching Bob Powell reminded me. The incident is depicted in Will Eisner's graphic novel, The Dreamer, a memoir about the early days of the comics industry with the names slightly changed. The George Tuska character is named Gar Tooth. Not sure whether that's simple word place on tusk or in tooth or whether it's a reference to the trademark Tuska teeth he was known for drawing. The Bob Powell counterpart was named Bo Bowers, and the other studio employees included Lou Sharp, who was Lou Fine, and Jack King, Jack Kirby, of course. Wow, Eric, that's fantastic knowledge. I have read very little of Eisner's work other than a handful of spirit stories, so I have got to go check that out. Thanks for letting us know about that.
Next up, our Bat Cousin Martin Gray, guest of this very episode. The Detective Comics number 486 cover is pretty good, but I miss the days when the dollar comic foregrounded Robin and Batgirl. Hey-ho! That woman's head in the Dick Giordano image is totally a Joe Staten head. What's going on? I've never heard of proofreading backwards. Sean, are you having us on? I've proofread thousands of pages, but never backwards. So yeah, that is true. So when this is absolutely true. When I have to proofread something, obviously I read it forwards. But if you look at each word backwards, for me, I'm more likely to see if a word is spelled incorrectly. Now, you do still have to read it forward, because in words like the word to, where it's T-O, T-O-O, or T-W-O, you can spell that wrong. And if you're reading it backwards, you won't recognize it because you don't see how you're supposed to use it. If you're reading a loaf of bread and it's L-O-O-F, because that's not a word, you'll see it when you read backwards. But if you're just reading along like you normally do, sometimes your head auto-corrects it.
So you're not doing like Zatanna and each word is backwards. You're not reading the letters backwards. You're reading each word in a backwards order.
I'm reading each word almost kind of like a Yoda. So Batman Family Reunion, I would read Reunion Family Batman. Not N-O-I-N-U-E-R. No. In our script, backwards never, but pages of thousands, proofread I've on us having you are. So like that, I look at each word. He didn't spell anything wrong, so that was great. Okay, now going on with Martin. I'm with Sean. I was always hugely disappointed if an anniversary issue of Brave and the Bold or DC Comics Presents turned out to be basically just another issue of World's Finest with Superman and Batman together rather than someone I've never seen previously. Sean, you don't have to restrict yourself to bald superheroes and villains for cosplay. You could also do people with hats. Just imagine how awesome you would look as Sargon the Sorcerer with a lovely yellow bejeweled turban. And I love that because when I think of turbans, I think of Patti LuPone. So I agree. Time Warp has perhaps the best logo ever. Unsurprisingly, it's by the great Todd Klein. Shame the book lasted just 5 issues. Let's do the Time Warp again.
I got that one.
Sea Devils in the Human Target. Well, at least that adds a single point of interest. You know that was Martin writing that, not me saying that. I tell a lie. We got another skeleton. Editor Paul Levitz should have latched onto the skeleton bit and given us dem bones in every story in this issue. And how wonderful to have a Don Heck fan on the show in the shape of Dan. The next issue blurb is intriguing. I can't wait to read the Scotland set The Things That Go Bump in the Night contract in the following issue, Detective Comics 487. Hang on. I looked through the following issues to the end of the Dollar Comics period, and the story never shows up. I wonder if it's in a DC drawer somewhere. Well, I still have the list of Human Target stories taped up on my wall because I'm too lazy to take it down. And now I don't want to until the end of the run. Yeah, that story is not listed in any of the Human Target appearances. So did he just have this idea for a story and then it just didn't pan out, so he didn't write it? Or did he write it and it's in inventory? It would be a great addition to the Human Target trade paperback.
There you go. He collected.
Martin then goes on, regarding the Batgirl story, why were those victims needing someone to fight in their corner? Whatever happened to Bruce Wayne's Victims Inc. project? And then he says, I admit it, I'm one of the unsigned letter writers in this issue's letter column. May I be on the show? And we talked about that, and he was making a joke. So very good, Martin. This is easily my favorite comment. Could be my favorite comment ever. That Wonder Woman hostess ad sounds about as good as any hostess ad. And I wouldn't worry if those pies are still floating in space after 45 years. They'll taste just as good as they ever did. That is exactly true. I enjoyed the respectful tribute to George Tuska. I always liked his stuff, even his Legion. Thanks for reading out my feedback. In my comments, the student is definitely positively dead. It isn't a Monty Python reference. It's from Candor and Ebb's musical, Curtains, the song The Woman's Dead. I've never even heard of that musical, so thanks, Martin. Okay, now this one I'll read very carefully. And I pointed out a quote in the Robin story in which a cop had yelled, due to a lettering error, Viola, instant clue, Viola. But it was read out by Sean as voila, as in what it should have been in the first place. So you missed my, Martin's, hilarious gag. I reckon his mind is out of tune. Martin, that is very good. And I'm sorry I botched that up.
You should have read it backwards.
But yeah, see, that's where proofreading backwards doesn't necessarily catch it. Because also, Denny Lane was a brilliant chance for some Beatles. You know, Penny Lane. But I guess I'm too subtle. That's me all over. My reference around previous Batman Family guest Terry in a gold suit was the song Making It, the theme song to the 70s sitcom Making It. And then he says, You're So Young, which, thank you, Martin, but that's not true. Because I do remember that TV show, and I remember that song. It's like, Making It, this time in life I'm taking it. And then Martin finishes, When I said Jason Bard wasn't half lazy, that's not a reference to anything. If we say someone isn't half something, that means they're wholly something. Do you not use that expression in the U.S.? Sorry, yeah, we don't use that expression in the U.S. We don't half use that expression in the U.S.
Next up, Bat Cousin Lizanne Oswalt stopped by the reunion. Impressive podcast, most impressive. This is a cool cover. The inside cover, well, splash page looks great too. Commenting on the scene in Arkham, she says, Hey, it's the Joker. He's going to ham it up for his cameo. Just be lucky he didn't do card tricks or juggle in the background. Also, the lawyer Max is talking to is stealing his gimmick with a loud purple suit. He's lucky the Joker didn't show him the pencil trip. Ouch, Lizanne. That would have hurt. The Human Target. There is a full-face scuba mask that's close to this, and I saw on Google search, but not exact, so some artistic license was taken. And then Lizanne does have a lot of comments about fashion and all the stories. Check out her thoughts on the website. Thanks for posting, Lizanne.
Bat DJ Matthew Davis says, Good February, Bat Cousins. Sean, I'm starting to find your lack of 70s and 80s music knowledge disturbing. Okay, maybe Snowblind isn't one of Styx's better known songs, but you haven't heard Empty Garden? Elton John wrote it after the death of his friend, you may have heard of, John Lennon, right? I think I know that song. Does he say Empty Garden? Is that the Hey Hey Johnny song? I think that's what that
is. Yeah, I think that's what it is.
Now, I will say, if they're like rock or hard rock or heavy metal, yeah, I won't know them. DC made an interesting decision to alternate the storylines. Two issues with Maxi Zeus, then the League, now back to Maxi, and next issue, the League again. That doesn't make it easy to collect it into a trade paperback. Human Target, Kokomo by the Beach Boys. I certainly know Kokomo. I don't have the original issue. Was there an editor's note somewhere saying who Dane Dorrance was? No, there was not. Anytime someone has like that kind of name, you can Google it and figure it has some kind of meaning. I get the feeling at the time, I knew he and Judy were older existing characters. The Sea Devils last appeared in Showcase 100 over a year before this, but that would have been the only time I had seen them.
You know, I'll just put in, the only reason I really knew is, as I mentioned on the show, I had read all those Showcase Sea Devils stories. So I saw Dane Dorrance. I'm like, I know who that is. Otherwise, I never read the Sea Devils.
It's a pretty distinct name. My fourth grade teacher was named Dane, and that has stayed with me. Batgirl, Runaway by Bon Jovi. So is that the, she's a little runaway, but I don't know if that's Bon Jovi or that's older. I don't know. Why did Donnie hitchhike? I've driven that DC, Baltimore, Philly, New Jersey, New York stretch where Gotham is supposed to be. Google Maps says DC to Newark is 216 miles or 3 hours, 47 minutes. It may seem further because of all the major metro areas. Why not take a bus or the train? Faster than hitchhiking, cheaper than flying, and on the train, he might have struck up a conversation with the then senator slash future US president commuting from Delaware. Well, my guess is he's a kid, and especially kids back then didn't have money. So probably when you say it's cheaper than flying, yeah, but nothing's cheaper than free. So if he's hitchhiking, Alfred, You Can Call Me Al by Paul Simon. Of course, I know this. Yay, an Alfred story. It was surprises like this that made the title fun. I agree. On page 4, Alfred had such a refined way to say, well, you didn't ask if I could open the safe. Gold ingots? Does he think Bruce Wayne is a Bond villain? Or a senator from New Jersey? Robin, Don't Fear the Reaper by Blue Oyster Cult. So I totally remember the song from when it came out. I think there's a version in Scream. I think that's a remake that I liked that version. One thing I've noticed about Schaffenberger's depiction of Robin, he's inconsistent with the domino mask. Most times we see the typical white eyes, but then we get a close-up like page 10, panel 4, where we see Robin's eyes and even a little bit of the skin around them. Another thought about that bed. It seems odd that someone with claustrophobia would have a canopy bed. Fun episode, guys. Now, get to work on that YouTube playlist for Sean's musical education.
And finally, our Bat Cousin Brett Young comes by to close out the comments. Hey, Bat Cousins, I brought 1,000 boxes of Fruit Stripe gum. Can I interest either of you in my pyramid scheme? A subscription to Grit? Tell your friends.
My cousins used to sell Grit.
I'm starting to side with Sean on these box covers. The solid color block really diminishes the impact of the art. This cover would be way better as a full image with some dramatic word balloons about air travel safety or don't eat the chili or something. This era of Batman reminds me of a wealthy Jack Reacher, minus the killing, of course. A tough guy with a good heart going through town, beating the crap out of bad guys and throwing in a few quips. No aliens, no magic, just good old-fashioned detective work and broken bones. A few solid moments. Batman scuba-dooing his waiter mask off with a long-eared cowl underneath. And the Joker strolling through Arkham with no speaking lines. I'm glad they let him keep his hair gel in prison. A solid human target story. My life goal is to sport that white leisure suit slash open shirt on my next family vacation. You just have to send us pictures, Brett.
I want pictures. I was going to say that.
I just have to figure out how to convince the wife. I appreciate this story continuing the issue's theme of fully clothed skeletons. And yes, that is how you stun a shark, kids. What's it going to take for Batgirl to get some respect? Another story with Don Heck art and Killer Moth as the villain? Hey, DC, why not just have Vince Coletta pour sugar in her gas tank? Give Batgirl her due. And speaking of gas tanks, I admit I really liked Killer Moth's ride. Though if I was Killer Moth, I'd keep it away from Sensei's parking garage. The Allstate bill would be crazy high to fix a bunch of sword and throwing star scratches. Finally, let's give little Donnie some respect. He shakes off his dad's murder to hitchhike to DC so he can play off Barb Symphony and stay at her apartment. It doesn't work, but I respect his game. He'll have to settle for giving Barbara a dainty hand wave goodbye. Seriously, look at his hand on that last panel. Not much to say about the Alfred story, except why does Bruce have a sexy portrait of his mom hiding a wall safe? In the Robin story, I was disappointed that the buried guy wasn't a clothed skeleton. Stick to the theme, Jack C. Harris. And I know real estate comes cheap in Gotham, but that massive bedroom with a canopy bed and a crown on top? Come on now, man. Now I'm rooting for Scarecrow. Well, I gotta go. I left my fabric softener and hand grenade back at the dry cleaners. I better go get it before something bad happens. Thanks, Brett, as usual.
Thanks a lot. We're now gonna turn over to the social media portion of the show. Facebook and Twitter's likes and comments and retweets and all of those kind of things. We'll start with Facebook, and we'd like to thank Bill Bear, Mike Thomas, Terry O'Malley, Codex Omniversa, Chris Franklin, Brett Young, James Williams, Stan Peel, Herschel Mimas, Don Lindberg, Magazines and Monsters, Peroni Negroni, Jay Campbell, Max Romero, Tim Price, Tim Pinsonault, and Jack Dower. If that's a play on Jack Bauer, congratulations, because I got that. And even if it's not, congratulations, because in my headcanon, it is going to be that. So good job. Over on Twitter, we have Chris at BTO and Batbooks, Paul Pont, Liz Ann Oswald, Ryan Shufo, Isamu, Matt J, Dr. Pop Culture, CJ Hart Comics, Cindy Womack, Codec Omniverse, Grimace at Plead_JP, Rodney Trainum, Steve Whitbread, Sean, not Sean me, Sean S-E-A-N, and that's at SeanRT72, Jim Bao, Christy, Martin Gray, Irredeemable Shag and Firestorm Fan, which may be the same person. And then also on Twitter, on the Batman Family Reunion Twitter account, Martin Gray said, "It's great to have you back with another dense dive into Bronze Age Batman family affairs." And then Rodney Trainum said, "Enjoyed the episode so much, I listened to it twice."
Oh, wow.
Thank you, Rodney.
You get the award this month, Rodney.
Still not a fan of Maxi Zeus, but I wasn't a huge fan of King Tut either. Brave and the Bold 155, which was mentioned on the show, was one of the first comics I ever had. That book helped start the Bat fandom in me. All right.
All right.
And then also on our account, I swear this is not seeding for Superman Family Matters, but I was reading a bunch of my Superman Family issues, probably one that Paul gave me. And in it, Supergirl is doing a super feat. And she says, "With my legs wrapped around the stump, I can lean forward and, snatched him out of harm's way just in time. Batwoman couldn't have done it better." So Batgirl is acknowledging Batwoman's wonderfulness.
I think that does it. Before we sign off, though, as most of our listeners know, running the Fire and Water Podcast Network has gotten more costly over the years as more and more shows were added. So if you're enjoying what you hear on this show or any of the other shows, please consider becoming a patron. And at certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice. And our special thanks go out to our Bat cousin and future guest, Brian Shufo, who has asked to be named on Batman Family Reunion. Thanks, Brian. Remember, we're not all Bruce Wayne, but any small amount you can give helps defray the cost, and we promise that none of the money will go to our project to make our houses watertight. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FWpodcasts, and thanks.
That will do it for the feedback section and for episode 487. We want to thank our special guest, Martin Gray, for appearing on this episode. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you'll enjoy us next month as Batman faces the spook, and we also get the elongated man. Hey, he's a detective.